Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Wellwithal. Wellwithal believes that self-care is community care. Premium products crafted for your daily wellness, from sleep support to heart health to your daily regimen. 20% of Wellwithal's profits are committed to leading the fight for health equity. They won't stop until it is truly Wellwithal. And the Massachusetts Historical Society, presenting the Making History Gala, featuring American historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin, June 6th at the Fairmont Copley Plaza. Tickets at masshist.org/gala.
Today on Boston Public Radio, the Mueller investigation appears to be winding down. Could next week be the most consequential one for President Trump? Or, like every other consequential week of his presidency, will it end up being of no consequence for him? Meet the Press's Chuck Todd joins us for that and other political headlines. Then we'll get another take on all this with the recently appointed head of the National Security Subcommittee in the House, Congressman Stephen Lynch. Also find out why he's one of the few Democrats who hasn't jumped into the 2020 race.
And at noon, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order. Plus, is Aaron Smith responsible for making hip-hop mainstream? In his new book, the Washington Post arts reporter Jeff Eggers makes the case that the band's collaboration with Run DMC forever changed music. He joins us for that. Then Paul Revel joins us to go over the latest educational headlines. That's next on Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
We need a Mueller countdown clock in our studio. Joining us online for his take on the latest political headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck, as you know, is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Well, good day, guys. How are you? How are we doing?
Well,
excellent.
We're doing very well. But before we get to the Mueller countdown, this is a pretty scary story, Chuck, involving some of your colleagues there at MSNBC, where this white supremacist was arrested, apparently plotting to take out massive numbers of people, including prominent Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and journalists, including at your station, MSNBC, and at CNN. So what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I'm tired of feeling numb to the fact that this has become so commonplace, right? This is now only 4 months removed from the pipe bomber guy. Mm-hmm. Same thing. What are we, about 8 months removed from the synagogue shooting? By the way, all three of these guys, their profile, awfully similar. Awfully similar, sort of loner, resentful, middle-aged, you know, sort of fired up, two of them fired up about race and white supremacy, you know, and all of them apparently motivated in some form by either support for the president or sympathy for the president. Look, the president's not responsible, but he has a responsibility. And when, he, you know, the fact is his words have been insightful, not insightful with an S, a different kind of inciting. And at a minimum, he has a responsibility to at least acknowledge there's no place for violence and that his words should not be misinterpreted as some sort of call to arms against the press. But we know he'll never would say something like that. And again, that's, you know, I wish I could say more anymore, but we know he won't do anything. We know he doesn't seem to care. He doesn't believe this is as bad as it is because he still thinks it's all a game. But, you know, it's not.
You know, one last thing about this. I listened to the publisher of The New York Times, Sulzberger, in the Daily mm-hmm. podcast, in a conversation with the president about his mm-hmm. calling the press the enemy of the people. And he talked about how, Sulzberger that is, how he had this normal conversation explaining the long history of authoritarian leaders calling the press enemy of the people, how this is a bad thing. And he said Trump seemed to listen to him very intently, understand what he was talking about. And this was, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, maybe 8 weeks ago. Other people have pointed out how this is a dangerous term. So you wonder, does he not, I mean, you just said he thinks everything is a game, but does he not, does he listen to someone intently and then just ignore it? Or, I mean, it's odd that he doesn't have to apologize, but he can just stop using that term. That's fairly subtle without admitting a mistake. You know what I mean?
Oh, look, I think he, I again, I think that he thinks that that people know that he doesn't mean it and that he will. But the other thing about him is he always makes the person in the room feel as if he is listening to them. This is why anybody who has a meeting with him, they go, wow, the president really listened to me on my idea to confiscate all guns, or the president really listened to me on my idea to ban evangelicals. You know, my point is that Trump takes, this is what makes him sort of such an odd duck, because he wants to be taken seriously by everybody, no matter how kooky some of his ideas are. He actually will be open-minded to, and make people think, even on things he disagrees with, that he's open-minded to it. So I do think a lot of this is just sort of part of his, just part of his style, part of his working style.
So Chuck Todd, do the reporters at NBC News buy the notion that it's about to be Mueller time probably next week?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We actually were the first ones to report the following, and this is what everybody is reporting. And I want to make everybody be careful here. The Justice Department is preparing for the end of the Mueller report. That doesn't mean it's definitely coming, but it's Justice Department officials. We have not, nobody has gotten direct quotes from Mueller. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been tea leaf reading. I thought the Post did a good job of noting how he's down to 14 lawyers, and lawyers that were on leave from different firms have told their firms they're about to come back. So there's clearly an end game here. But if this is the end game, there's a lot of threads that haven't been tied up yet, right?
Like what?
The biggest one being Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
Are you telling me he's never going to indict or interview him? You know, he's never been interviewed by Mueller, and the assumption was it's because he was a likely, just like Stone had never been interviewed, and Stone eventually got indicted. So the question, what's happening to that?
What's the answer to the question?
I don't know, right? What happens to Donald Trump Jr.? Is it now? I had a prosecutor on yesterday, Harry Littman, said, when I asked him, I said, so this definitely means Mueller's not subpoenaing the president. He said, well, if you were going to do that, you might wait to the very end to issue your subpoena for the president. So I guess I'm curious to see if we are coming to the end. I think there's going to be a grand finale, put it that way.
How much pressure is there on new Attorney General Barr to be as transparent as the public and Democratic members of Congress would like?
Well, it's interesting. You know, he is the currently the most unfireable person in Trump's orbit. Right now, that he isn't going to be there for very long. But right now, the president can't immediately up and fire another attorney general. So, right, he can't. Like,
oh,
so,
gosh.
Barr. I say this because I am not prejudging Barr here. I think Barr cares about his reputation in Washington. I think he cares about his reputation in the legal community. Mm-hmm. I don't think Barr is going to do anything to cover up on behalf of Donald Trump. I really don't. I think he is going to follow the letter of the law. I think he will feel some pressure to be as transparent as possible within the boundaries of the statute. But one thing about Barr is he will follow it to a T. And that will be uncomfortable, folks. But you know what? Considering all the James Comeys of the world that didn't follow regulation to a T, I think at the end of the day, we should hope that regulation is followed to a T. So I do think he will. But I also think he's got more political capital here in Trump world to be more transparent about it. Because frankly, I think we all agree, this is too important for there to be ambiguity, whether you believe in Trump or you don't believe in Trump. I think everybody thinks it's in the best interest of the country to see the complete investigation of what Russia did to interfere in the presidential election. This is like the Warren Commission. This is the 9/11 Commission. The Russians attacked our election system. Mueller's job was to find out how they did it and why they did it.
Okay, I hope you're going to disabuse me of a notion I've heard some people write about and be quoted about, and I apologize, I don't have the prosecutor who's said this in front of me, but the idea, we've all been hysterical about how much, you know, Barr's going to let us see, or Congress, or what are we going to see in the Mueller report. I heard a couple of people repeat the theory yesterday and the day before that Mueller could issue a very you know, kind of the cliff notes, sparse, a prosecutorial statement which doesn't even answer whether there was collusion or not.
How could he do that?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an expert, well, but I've heard people who are prosecutors say this.
Well, Marjorie, and what they're getting at, it's what the Watergate special prosecutor essentially did. Sparse report, but left a trail for Congress to investigate. Mm. I think it depends on if Mueller is counting on Congress to essentially expose the report to the public, then that's the route you described as the route I'll take. I happen to believe that one thing Barr might do is, out of fear of having the Democrats release it, be on the side of being proactive to do it yourself, right? Don't leave this up to congressional subpoena. Don't leave this up to Mueller being subpoenaed in front of Congress to speak his report. You know what I mean? There is a ton of ways to get the information out of Mueller if he decides to do it the way you're describing, the way others have driven, which is, again, that was what the Watergate prosecutor did. That's why it's being floated out there as a possible way to be.
Thank you. I feel better.
Chuck Todd, did you take a psychology course in college or no?
No, I didn't. Perfect. But I did sleep at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
Oh, that's it. That's good enough. I learned a term yesterday that I'm obsessed with now. It's called the normalization of deviance. And the reason it came up is Marjorie and I spent a lot of time on the show yesterday saying, okay, yesterday the New York Times has a 4,500-page story essentially saying the president has obstructed justice, particularly in the Southern District of New York and beyond. People like your own Savannah Guthrie and others interview Andrew McCabe, who says the president of the United States may still be a Russian asset. And to say that there's indifference, we go to the tweets of the Democratic presidential candidates. Kamala Harris is saying hello to the good people of Iowa. Bernie Sanders is bragging about raising $6 million. How do you explain such a tepid reaction to what at least I consider, and I think Marjorie did too, a huge news day?
You know, it's funny you say that. And I think Democrats need to be careful of setting an unintended precedent, because I know exactly what you're talking about. I've thought about this too. I think there's plenty of Democrats now who are on the side of, let's just beat Trump at the election.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, you can't let this go. If we don't, this is the most, I mean, the charge, the basic allegation against the sitting president of the United States is the most serious in the history of the Republic. Okay? Working with a foreign power,
yeah,
right? To steal the presidency, okay? Let's say it was that extreme, right? What's being investigated here. So I'm with you. I think there are times where the Democratic presidential candidates don't act with urgency about the situation we're in. And I wonder if Democratic primary voters are going to be, if that's going to bother them. You know, Tom Steyer is the one man band that's
Mr. Impeach.
Trying to get people to impeach.
Yeah.
It sounds like he's ready to sign you up.
No. I just want a discussion. I'm not taking a position.
No,
it's just...
I agree. No, but I know what you mean. Why are you turning a blind eye to the conversation everybody else in America is having, right? That's essentially what you're saying.
That
right?
is what I'm saying, yeah. We're talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. I'm sorry, Chuck. What?
No. Look, you know, I always thought this is the lesson candidates ought to take from Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump was never on message on a day. He always reacted to the news during his campaign and made him more relevant.
Yeah, I mean, pretty well.
You know, sometimes I think that just because he's Trump doesn't mean everything he did was bad or not a good idea.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Well, he did a lot of good things as a candidate, I guess, because he won.
He did win. Yeah, that's a good
right.
point.
So, he's very good at looking accessible. I'm not saying he is accessible, but he's very good at looking accessible. That's a good talent.
So what's going to happen with the emergency on the border and the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi?
Well, what's going to be more interesting is what's going to happen in the United States Senate after the vote on disapproval passes the House of Representatives. Look, I'll be curious to see how many Republican votes are in the House. But I'm not as curious as I will to see the number of Republican votes in the Senate to vote for the disapproval. And I, you know, it's one of those things, either the Trump loses one or two votes and he doesn't have to veto it, or he loses like 30 votes. You know what I mean? I think if you're going to buck the president, if he's going to lose that vote, I bet you a whole bunch of Senate. It's one of those things that either only two Republicans vote for the disapproval or like 30 do it. Like there might not be an in between.
So
but once the dam breaks, they all get on that.
So who's the ringleader? Is there somebody that's going to be corralling the votes? So
how about Mitt Romney
sticks out
as
by
a
himself?
Possibility?
I don't know.
I mean,
well,
Romney
that would be an interesting one.
Yeah.
I assume Rubio wouldn't do that. Lindsey is going to vote with the president. We know that. So maybe Ben Sasse, but I don't know if he's got a lot of sway inside the Republican conference. But look, I keep my eye on Sasse, and you guys, you know, maybe on Romney. Although I haven't seen evidence yet that Romney's ready to lead yet.
Though he does say he's troubled, like a lot of them do, by national
that.
Emergency declaration. No, I agree with you. I agree.
Yeah, I don't mean it's just early. It's just, you know, he's. I actually think if he tried too hard to lead now, he would get smacked down quick. You know, you're still new guy in the Senate.
Yeah, like that 29-year-old kid who hasn't spoken in the House at all since she was elected like 2 months ago.
And again, yeah, I know. She's really biding her time.
Sure. So, Chuck Todd, before you go, you don't know this about me, but I've always had two professional dreams. One was that I would be the answer to a clue in a major crossword puzzle, and sadly, Marjorie beat me to that.
No,
she was the answer
exciting.
To a clue in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago. And my second dream, which you have achieved, and I have not yet, at least, is to be ridiculed on Saturday Night Live. Now, how did you react to your portrayal a week and a half ago?
Well, I fear it was funny. I was like relieved that I wasn't portrayed as portly or without hair. So, I could have done without the subject matter.
Yeah, the subject matter was Jeff Bezos' private parts, yes.
Yeah, his photographed private parts, let's, you know. But it was, I will say this, my 15-year-old was like, you know, send me a link from her Instagram page, sent me a link in text and said, hey, not bad.
Do you know, by the way, as
and
an NBC guy,
said,
do you know,
said
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They got the hand. She said that the most impressive thing, she goes, they got your hand gesture.
It was great.
Do you know, as an NBC guy, do you know prior to the broadcast that you're featured?
Yes, because they borrowed, a couple things from our set. So we knew our set,
we knew
Meet the Press was going to be used. So they were borrowing some sort of graphic. So I didn't know actually until I woke up Sunday morning. But I had gotten a bunch of emails about it saying, hey, heads up.
Yeah. Let me just tell you, my jealousy knows no bounds,
my friend.
It was a great segment.
Oh,
man.
Chuck, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Up next, Jim and I are going to spend a couple of minutes talking about the Mueller investigation. Suppose it turns out to be anticlimactic. Is that good news for the nation? Bad news for political junkies and never-Trumpers? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press about the Mueller investigation and whether it'll be the bombshell that many people think or thought it would be, and the Mueller watch. Immediately, a couple of minutes ago, maybe 10 minutes ago, CNN had a poll, which not surprisingly to me, Marjorie, relating to the issue of how much is Barr release, Attorney General Barr release, 87-9. There are no polls like that. That's essentially unanimous. 87% of the population to 9 wants the Mueller report, whatever it is, to be made public. You know, one of the fears I have, David Gergen was on my show last night, and one of the things I broached with him is the polarization that exists and the locked-in polarization. We're actually going to talk to a Princeton historian who's written a book in part about this in an hour or so, is so intense that I worry if the report is exculpatory for the president and his closest allies, the Democrats are going to say it's BS. If the report has a bill of particulars, crimes and other things against those closest to the president, maybe even the president himself, that the Republicans are not going to accept it. So it's not just what's in it, I know, which is causing you anxiety. The response we're going to get from the people we sent to Washington, we're going to talk to Steve Lynch, obviously a Democratic congressman, in about 5 minutes or so in studio. That worries me almost as much as the content, what the reaction is going to be.
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to call it BS, since people have been singing the praises of Bob Mueller now for months and months and months. I mean, what the Democrats could do, as people have talked about, is, you know, hold hearings, have Mueller in there, question him. I mean, I was really upset last night to hear these prosecutors, and I just, as I mentioned this to Chuck Todd, and other people have written this, that this could be just a little synopsis, arriving at no conclusions. I think a lot of Americans want to know, well, was there collusion on the part of the president? Or was this just his campaign and he didn't know anything
about
it?
Or was there even collusion on the part of the campaign? I mean, we know about the Manafort connections.
Well, I think we're pretty close with Roger Stone.
I think you want it spelled out in excruciating detail, the good and the bad. And if people are worried, by the way, I don't know if you read this thing this morning in The New Yorker, which I think is very good news for the American public. The headline says, Bezos says Amazon drones ready to deliver Mueller report to every American household. That's our satirist friend, Andy Barwitz. Amazon drones stand ready and waiting to deliver copies of Mueller's official report free of charge to every American household as early as next week. The Amazon founder, Jeff Bezos, confirmed. He said, Amazon will be doing same-day delivery of Mueller's report the day it's released free of charge to both prime and non-prime households. Bezos said, this is our way of giving something something back. But I have to say, there have been, in our lifetimes, there have only been maybe five huge moments of this kind of anticipation. This is one of them. I mean, this is a huge and important moment for America and our democracy.
You know, there's been some retrenchment after the Starr report, which, as we all know, went into excruciating detail about what sort of sexual things.
Was it 500 pages or 400 pages or something?
Were going on in the Oval Office. And I do think the American public could have done without that. I mean, do we need to have all these graphic images like implanted in our brain forever? I don't think so. So,
but you can't have it both ways. You were just saying, I surely hope Mueller answers these key questions. I mean, I think detail. I mean, a lot of people think Ken Starr was just doing it for salacious reasons, out to get the Clintons, that sort of thing.
Kavanaugh, the chief justice, the justice on the Supreme Court now, not chief justice, but the justice on the Supreme Court, he was a salacious boy. He wanted all that stuff back then.
But, you know, in light, as you said, there's virtually nobody who criticizes Mueller except the president of the United States. So my sense is that people are going to – I don't know if – I shouldn't even say – I don't know what people's reaction to this is going to be. It is so painfully partisan. It's ridiculous.
I think obviously people that don't like the president, and I'm one of them, will be disappointed if there isn't more nefarious, dastardly deeds.
Why would you be disappointed? I mean, you want Mueller to tell the truth as he sees it after he does it. And if he concludes that the president himself is collusive a word? I don't know.
Collusion.
If collusive. I know someone used it on CNN last night. Never heard it
collusive?
As an adjective. Yeah. In any case, and it didn't. Then that's what you want. Don't you want the facts
be? Yeah, you want the facts. You do want the facts. But I'm just saying that there's. It's not the only thing that's going on. I mean, we have the Southern District of New York investigation. You know, we have the investigation that they're doing into the inaugural committee with the investigation
that's
they're doing
into
his business dealing. So it's not the only investigation.
Well, you know why those are really important? Did we discuss this on radio or did I do it on TV the other night? The reason the Southern District is so – I think we did it here – is so terribly important is it appears the bulk of what they're investigating – that's a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Manhattan of New York
–
is they're not covered by executive privilege.
Correct.
They're not those issues there. They are the pre-presidential Donald Trump.
Money stuff.
And as a result, right, and as a result, I think we did discuss it here, as a result, the ability to have much more out front. You know, one of the things I'm really interested in, we've asked almost everybody from Congress about this. I hope Steve Lynch is now the chair of a key subcommittee. He's also on the Oversight Committee when he joins us in a couple of minutes. What power does Congress have? Let's assume, for argument's sake, that Mueller does what you want. He does spell things out in detail, maybe not excruciating detail, but he answers all the critical questions.
Well, you want that,
Attorney General Barr decides that virtually none of it is appropriate, that essentially he releases, I don't know, like a sticky note. Is what he releases the American people. What power does Congress have? Can Congress subpoena the whole unredacted, undisclosed report and make it public? I don't think so. Can it subpoena Bob Mueller and say, we want you to answer every question about the report, even if the report itself will not see the light of day because of the power vested in the Attorney General of the United States?
Well, I think they can subpoena Bob Mueller. The question is, what will Mueller say?
That's the question.
When we saw McCabe, who was the deputy director of the FBI on television the other night.
He was acting director, too.
He did not answer lots of questions because he said he can't comment on this because of a pending investigation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, as he also didn't answer, which I think in many cases compromises what he says. This is in the minds of many people, is he says because there is soon to be pending litigation. I guess it hasn't happened yet. Around the inspector general concluding that he lied three times under oath about leaks to reporters, that creates a lot of doubt about somebody who, I have to say, from having read all the stories, I believe, but that's like a big, I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions about a lot of things, and I'm with you. I hope Mueller, if he's as smart and patriotic as everybody says he is in the straight arrow that Michael Zeldin, for example, told us the other day is, a no-nonsense, just the facts, ma'am, kind of guy, I'm assuming he is going to answer all the questions. I don't think the issue is Bob Mueller. I think the issue is, what does William Barr think his responsibility is? And interestingly, Chuck Todd just said to us like almost exactly what you said, you've been saying about Barr, or hoping about Barr, it's the end of his career. It isn't like he's looking for his next job. He's
not. The same thing.
Did he say it to us the other day? And he's not, obviously there's no ambition. This is probably his final public job.
He's not
going to
get
stepped on by the president.
He wants to do the
right
thing. Exactly.
So, right. Or if the president attempts to step on him, he's not going to allow the stepping.
Yeah.
So the assumption is he will do what he believes in good faith is right for the country,
as
opposed to right for his, quote, boss, end quote, the president of the United States, who's not really his boss.
The other question, I think a lot of people who may not have grown particularly fond of the president's son, Don Jr., who tweets all the time, and sometimes the tweets are just outrageous, and who was at this meeting with the Russian lawyer that was supposed to be about adoptions, and we all know.
Mm-hmm. Trump Tower meeting.
The Trump Tower meeting. I think a lot of people thought there was going to be some sort of indictment of him.
Well, that's the major point that Chuck Todd made about the timing here. What happens to that?
Or Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Well, we don't know.
When the first indictment came out in this case, Borowitz, and if you haven't seen Andy Borowitz, it's really funny. Some days are better than others, like anybody else, but sometimes they are just laugh out loud funny. And he said something like, millions of Americans devastated that Jared Kushner was not the first guy to be indicted. So there's not a lot of love lost.
So what we're going to do probably tomorrow, and if not Monday, so you can be thinking about this in advance, is we're going to take your calls. We don't have time for it today, about how you're preparing, regardless of what your political posture is, for the release of the Mueller report. Again, almost all the stories from CNN, from NBC, from virtually everywhere, say the report will more than likely be delivered next week to the Attorney General. We don't know how fast he'll release it. By the way, the one other thing we didn't say to Chuck Todd is the conventional wisdom is the Attorney General would not release whatever he releases while the president is in Vietnam meeting with the leader of North Korea, because it sort of steps on this incredibly important summit.
I think if there is no collusion between the president and the Russians, this is going to be huge for Trump, obviously, and it could be huge for his reelection, because he will say, they spent 2 years trying to get me. This is a witch hunt. This is the deep state. He will reinforce everything he said. I think it's going to make it very it's going to make it much harder, I think, for Democrats to prevail against him. Anyway, We're not going to talk about this anymore because we're going to talk to Congressman Steve Lynch.
We're going to talk to him about it.
As Jim just said, we're going to talk about national security headlines. We're going to talk about something having to do with nuclear stuff. We're going to talk about the border wall, the Mueller investigation, all that coming up. Congressman Stephen Lynch is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. With the Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives last November, a number of Massachusetts congresspeople moved into very powerful positions. Among them is our next guest. Congressman Stephen Lynch is chair now of the House of Representatives National Security Subcommittee. He'll explain the jurisdiction to us in a minute. And he represents the 8th District? Is it the 8th District?
I'm the 8th now, yeah.
Congressman Lynch, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my honor. Thank you.
Your honor?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you, Congressman. We appreciate it.
Well,
feels good, doesn't it?
Both of my step there, absolutely. You know, we were just talking about this, Congressman, before you came in, about what happens if the Mueller report, which supposedly is about to be released, comes out and it's either there's not very much in it or it's just kind of a brief summary or a lot of stuff is redacted. Can the House say, we want Bob Mueller to come in and testify? What can they do?
We'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. But we're just waiting to see how much of this is redacted and how much is going to be disclosed. I think there are some, probably the Speaker, the Minority Leader, who will be able to read the entire report, and then there'll be a redacted version given to those based on levels of security clearance. But we will know the truth, and then the challenge will be to try to get all the relevant facts disclosed to the public and obviously have hearings on this and have a full-blown debate in Congress whether or not the transgressions rise to the level of impeachment.
Have those conversations, the impeachment conversations we can get to in a minute, have conversations already been going on amongst the leadership about how to deal with a report, assuming whether it's redactions or whatever Attorney General Barr decides are reasons to not disclose some of this report? And obviously some reasons are totally legitimate. National security concerns obviously are legitimate.
Right.
But I was just saying, there was a CNN poll this morning, 87% of the public, 87-9, believes the whole report should be made public. Are you guys already talking about strategies, or you're just waiting to see what Barr does?
Well, there's some doubt about Barr's objectivity on this, obviously.
Do you share that?
I do. Some of his statements, during the course of this whole investigation have been, negative towards the investigation. So, and he was hired by Trump, so there's a certain imprimatur of bias right in that based on the way the president has operated. But so at the end of the day, it may be a situation where we're going to have to fight out each redaction, and we're going to have to force Barr in camera, which is just between the judge and the complainants, I guess, to reveal what's behind each redaction. That may be a course we have to take, but that's what it is.
I mentioned you have a new chairmanship with incredibly broad jurisdiction. We had Jim McGovern on the other day, who was chair of the House Rules Committee.
Yeah,
nobody
great.
Knows what the Rules Committee does, except we
except
all know how
Jim.
Important it is, except Jim, exactly. And we obviously know that Richie Neal from Western Massachusetts is the chair of Ways and Means.
My rabbi. He's definitely in a great spot.
He is.
There.
Explain to us briefly, if you can, What kind of jurisdiction does this subcommittee that you're now chairing have?
Well, interestingly enough, the Committee on Oversight has unlimited jurisdiction. It's the only committee in Congress that has unlimited jurisdiction. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, it is. So wherever there's a problem on the globe that involves the United States or our personnel, military or otherwise, we basically focus on the problem. So, you know, that's why I've been to Iraq, you know, 30 times and Afghanistan 14 or 15 times. And so you never go anywhere nice, but it's a great committee if you really want to, you know, dig into some of the problems that we're having globally. So,
but the subcommittee that you're heading also has colossally broad jurisdiction too, does it not?
Right, national security. So anything from, you know, the situation we have on our southern border to, you know, Trump's arguments to withdraw 2,000 troops from Syria without informing the defense secretary. You know,
I just wonder, with Massachusetts congresspeople, you included, of course, being in really powerful positions now in the House. You mentioned McGovern and Richie Neal and stuff. When the Massachusetts delegation or you yourself goes into, like, the House gym, do people that are on the treadmill have to cede their spot to you, that kind of thing? Or
no,
they have to move out of the line
no.
if you're in the cafeteria? No.
But there's got to be a different mood. I mean, going to work when you're in the minority.
Look, it's never been better. I mean, look, so I've been in Congress since 2001, and it's never been better right now. I know people are out there saying, what are you talking about? It's a horror show. It is, but at least we have some control now over our own destiny, and we get to, you know, from an oversight position, there's been zero oversight. They've been steering all of the controversial cases to the Intelligence Committee, which has to work in a classified setting. So the public has been blocked out from all of this, all of these proceedings, and so we're going to change. We are changing that.
But,
I'm sorry.
At the beginning of Obama's term, the Democrats had everything. President, House,
for
Senate,
2 years,
right? So wasn't it better then?
Not better for me.
Okay. Okay.
You know, as a junior member at that point, and you know, I don't know. So right now, I have to say that even more than when President Obama was in office, there is a singularity of purpose within the Democratic caucus, and there is a sense of urgency. So while there was great optimism when President Obama came in, you know, it was sort of disparate. It was spread out. There was no definition to it. And then, but in this case, I think the Democrats feel like we need to save the world.
Okay, you know, we urgency need to save about the president.
Yeah, save the country and save the world.
You know, speaking of saving the world, yesterday we had a reporter in from the world who just came back from Saudi Arabia and did some wonderful reporting. The first of her reports was about women finally being able to drive, the last country in the world. And it's a really important issue. But speaking of important issues in Saudi Arabia and the House Oversight Committee, what was disclosed about nuclear information and Saudi Arabia. Can you describe
what
our government is doing, Congressman Lynch?
Yeah, so I got off the plane. We went to that Munich security conference. And
we want to talk about that in a minute.
And I come down the gate and my staff's there with a full briefing for me. And they said, you're not going to believe this. But, you know, there's indications from multiple whistleblowers that people in the White House and attached to the administration were in active negotiations to transfer sensitive nuclear technology to the Saudis, which is a clear violation of the Atomic Energy Act, which requires Congress to review any such application. But apparently, there are associates of Mr. Kushner and the president that were engaged in these talks. And as we drill down further, there are some companies there that were near bankruptcy that have some other commercial dealings with the Kushner family properties where they came in and made major infusions of cash to certain properties that Kushner is having trouble with. And they are also involved in this attempt to resurrect this bankrupt nuclear energy company in order to partake in the so-called Middle East Marshall Plan from which they would benefit greatly.
So there are hearings about – will there be hearings on this?
Oh, yeah.
Big and time. By the way, for those that know, Kushner and the Crown Prince are buddies.
So last night we – that's right. So last night we sent over a detailed list of documents after speaking to the whistleblowers, and some of them are so specific that you know, the recipient is going to know that we know that these documents exist, and so we're waiting to get that information. And also, we've put together a list of individuals that we want to see come in and testify.
We're talking to Congressman Steve Lynch.
I don't mean to get carried away here, yeah. But to give sensitive nuclear technology and information to the Saudis,
right?
That's a big. That's huge. That's almost.
Is I
that,
think so.
I
yeah.
don't mean to throw on the word treasonous, but I mean that's
yeah
nuts.
It's so from a national security perspective, that is you know, detrimental to our national security. Putting it out there. I mean, you know, there's no denying that. So we're interested in hearing what their response is.
But it's not. But since it's been discovered now, it's not happening. It's ended, or we just don't know.
We don't know.
We're talking to Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman, you said a minute ago you were at that Munich Security Conference. I'm embarrassed to say virtually the only thing I know about the conference is the video that we've all seen a million times where Vice President Pence gets up and delivers applause lines to which there was total silence. Like, I bring you greetings from a man who believes deeply in freedom, the 45th president of the United States. And there's utter silence.
Yeah, was it
clear in the was I'm curious.
Yeah.
Was it clear in the room how painful it was? Because I have to say, watching on my computer, it was about as awkward as anything could get.
It was. He brought a little contingent with him, and they sat in the front row in front of him. So it was Ivanka Trump and others. But and they stood up and clapped, you know. But that was it, you know.
Nobody.
No, it just and then some of the other lines too. At one point, he demanded that the nations of Europe join together and withdraw from the JCPOA, and that received no positive response.
Did you
either.
Meet with the president of Afghanistan when you were there? I know you've said you've been 14.
And
what's the status of our withdrawal, non-withdrawal? Where are we, and what's going on there?
So, okay, as you know, the president tweeted out that he was pulling out half of the troops.
Our president,
President Trump tweeted out that he was withdrawing half of the troops in Afghanistan, which would be about half, would be about 7,000 of the 14,000 that are there. However, when we talked to General Milley and General Dunford, who's the head of the Joint Chiefs, they said that they had received no orders for drawdown. So that means it was just a tweet and that there was nothing there. I get the sense that because this was a similar thing that happened in Syria, where there was a tweet that the president was pulling out 2,000 troops from Manbij in a very sensitive area near the Turkish border. And so no drawdown was affected there either. So I think it's just the president getting up or being up late at night and just tweeting out. But it really is very, very disruptive to our own national security. And one more thing he did. So while we were at the Munich Security Conference, he tweeted out that the United States was going to deport 800 Syrian fighters. Fighters taken on the battlefield in Syria and deport them to whatever country that they previously came from. And we happened to be in a meeting that afternoon with the Prime Minister of Belgium. And his response was, really? This is how you handle this? He was extremely upset, saying that, you know, I would have liked a phone call on this, because there are a number of Belgian, you know, nationals that were captured on the battlefield. They have a big, you know, Arab population there. Anyway, said, I would just like a notice of this. You've got my people all upset because it went right into the media. So the Belgian people are saying, hey, what's going on here? So, you know, it just does not go well when you do things like that.
You know, beyond the process, almost everybody who is relatively sane agrees that important foreign policy should not be made by tweet,
right,
with failure to consult with people who have expertise, whether it's members of Congress, the generals, whomever it is. But I have to say, it is Afghanistan. You know much better than I, as America's longest war.
Yeah.
I'm not, as a citizen, I'm not crazy about having men and women be there forever. A couple of things. Other than the process the president engaged in, Where are you on sitting down with the Taliban and trying to negotiate a peace on some withdrawal plan? What should we be doing in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, the Taliban have not agreed to sit down with the government there, the incumbent government, so President Ghani and others. So that's a problem. They're negotiating with us and the Pakistanis and some others. So that, you know, you question the legitimacy of these negotiations. And also the big question, I think, that we leave behind there in this negotiations is the status of women and whether or not we can trust Taliban involvement in the government to elevate or even maintain some of the freedoms that women enjoy in Afghanistan. So that's a huge issue. So if you understand the flow rate here, so these young men are coming out of Diobandi madrasas in southern Afghanistan and northern Pakistan, and they are the farm team for the Taliban, and they believe in a very, very severe, strict, austere version of Islam in which women are basically personal property and have no rights. So how can you integrate that element into a democratic government that respects the rights of women? And so that's the thorniest problem, and it's the big problem I have about negotiating with the Taliban. And that's the one we haven't overcome yet. So we need to look very closely, and we told President Ghani that's a problem, that any resulting agreement we don't think has the ability to elevate the rights of women in that society. And I think it would be terrible for the United States to sign on the dotted line to relegate all those women to slavery, basically.
Have you seen the film that Charlie Sennett, our colleague down the hall from the Ground Truth Project, one of the people he works with,
made a film about... I saw him. I was walking down the street in Afghanistan. I ran into him.
And you bumped into
him? Yeah.
Charlie Sennett?
Yeah,
Charlie, Have you seen...
I did not think I would meet somebody I knew.
Have you seen the film about the woman who's from a suburb here,
oh, yeah.
Razia John,
Wellesley,
who opened a school for girls? It is... If people haven't seen it at home...
It's great. Yeah.
It's one of the most beautiful films about... strength and leadership and initiative. It's just great. We're talking to Congressman Stephen Lynch.
You know, Congressman, just maybe backtrack for a second. You spoke before about, it was a good time in being in the House now, and there's a singleness of purpose and urgency. What do your colleagues talk about? That what are they most worried about with the Trump presidency that causes this urgency and singleness of purpose?
Well, there's a long list. Just the way he handles the day-to-day functions of government. He lacks basic respect for the institutions of government. His interactions with the House and Senate are very sporadic, and he's prone to very erratic behavior. At least early in his administration, I think there was some reticence on his part, especially in global and military matters. He would defer to, at times, General Kelly or General Mattis, and he did not venture into that area, basically conceding the fact that he didn't know anything about that. But now, after 2 years of being in office, he's very dismissive of that. So Mattis is gone, Kelly's gone. A number of others are gone, and so now he's venturing out there saying he knows more than the generals, and that really frightens people. I think Speaker Pelosi has done an excellent job in sort of being a counterbalance and being a mature adult in the room in terms of our dealing on the House side with Trump. But he just lacks a certain level of maturity and discipline. That I think he doesn't fully appreciate the power that he has, and I had an opportunity to get down to a mosque in Quincy when he had introduced that Muslim ban, I tried to explain to the congregation, the Ummah, I said, you have to understand, and they were very, very, very upset, obviously, but I said, you have to understand the way our government works. The founders of our government established, three co-equal branches of government. And they did that with checks and balances on the executive so that any one person can't screw this all up. And I said, we are testing that system right now.
Yeah, Congressman Lynch, we only have a minute or so left. I want to get back to use the I word impeachment a couple of minutes ago. We just got off the phone with Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. And we were talking about how what I think all three of us consider to be a stunningly indifferent response to a 4,500 word story, I think making the case for obstruction of justice in the New York Times the other day. A former acting FBI director, McCabe, saying that he believes the president might today be a Russian asset, that it's possible. Utter indifference from the Democrats who want to be president. They're tweeting about how much money they've raised. They're going to Iowa, all this sort of thing. And he said there's a I'm putting words in Chuck's mouth, but the essence was that Democratic presidential candidates have some fear of sort of confronting Trump on some of these issues for maybe electoral implications. If the Mueller report is an indictment, I don't mean that as a term of art, but essentially an indictment of Donald Trump, are you and your fellow Democrats ready to begin an impeachment proceeding if you think it's merited, or will it be one of those things where we'll let the voters decide in November?
No, if the facts support impeachment, we will seek to impeach.
Do you I know you're waiting for the Mueller report. Based on what you know, and you know a lot, I mean, because of your committee assignments and your responsibilities, based on what you know, do you believe the facts will be there?
I'd say the odds are 60-40 that they will be right now, but I can't make – that would be pure speculation because I don't know what else is there. There could be mitigating facts to what I believe are true today. So I would say there are certainly strong indicia, especially with respect to the dismissal of Director Comey, and some statements that were made by the president that certainly would indicate that there were, nefarious reasons for his dismissal and for interfering with the work that he was doing. So, but I want to get, before I answer that question, I want to make a full, thorough, thoughtful, legal analysis of everything that we have. And then we'll decide, I think, member by member, whether to go forward.
Make sure we get the same opportunity that you get.
Yeah.
Do that, Congressman. Yeah.
The redacted version, of course.
Congressman, really appreciate you coming in. It's great to see you. Congratulations on the new committee chairman.
Absolutely great to see you, Congressman. Stephen Lynch is the chairman of the House of Representatives National Security Subcommittee. He represents the 8th District. Coming up, a former Suffolk County Sheriff, Andrew Cabrera, joins us for another edition of Law & Order. We're going to talk about that crazy incident with the actor from Empire staging, apparently, an attack on himself. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, yesterday, in a unanimous decision, the Supreme Court ruled the Constitution puts limits on the ability of states and localities to seize property used to commit crimes. On today's edition of Law & Order, we'll talk to former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral about how this could change policing. Then we look at a song that changed pop culture forever. In his new book, Jeff Edgers makes the convincing case that the Aerosmith Run DMC mashup of Walk This Way was the Billboard hit that made hip-hop mainstream.
Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us to go over the latest education headlines. Then we talk to historian Julian Zelizer about the divided states of America. How do we get to this point of bleak polarization? In his new book, he traces it all back to 1974, when economic inequality and distrust in the government eroded our belief in the American way. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, hour number 2. Hello again, Jim.
You know what I forgot to do at the end of Congressman Lynch? I meant to say, but I couldn't read my writing. Speaking of Boston Congress people, the other Boston Congressperson, Anna Pressley, she's joining us on tomorrow's show, but because of her schedule, we've got to pre-tape the discussion at the library. She'll be joining us at 9 o'clock tomorrow. The show formally starts at 11. But if you'd like to see our interview with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley in the flesh, that'll be 9 o'clock tomorrow morning when the library opens, the Boston Public Library downtown. So in any case, here is in Studio 3 today, though, right now, for another edition of Law & Order, is Andrew Cabral. Andrew is the former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety for Deval Patrick, and current CEO of Ascend. Hello, Andrew Cabral.
Hello, hello.
Well, hello, Andrew Cabral. We're going to start with some sound today because it was just really something. We just saw it on television. This is Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson talking about Jussie Smollett and claiming... Well, not he wasn't claiming, actually. He definitively stated that Smollett lied about this attack on him to promote his career because he wasn't making enough in his salary. This was during a press conference this morning.
This announcement today recognizes that Empire actor Jussie Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism to promote his career. I'm left hanging my head and asking why. Why would anyone, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations? How could someone look at the hatred and suffering associated with that symbol and see an opportunity to manipulate that symbol to further his own public profile?
And, you know, then you read further into the story and you realize the Smollett wrote a check to these two guys that he paid to stage this attack on him, which is so bizarre because why would you write a check if you were trying to cover it up? Why would you do this to begin with? I'll shut up. What is your take on this whole thing?
My take on it is that he perpetrated, allegedly anyway, there seems to be some strong evidence that he perpetrated a hoax for his own personal reasons, whether it was personal ambition or... you know, he wanted an increase in salary or he wanted to make the leap to film. I'm not sure exactly what the if there's a singular motivation or multiple motivations, but that he is in many ways no different than anyone else who's ever perpetrated a hoax on as large a scale as this, you know, to the country. That's happened certainly a lot in our history where you hear what you hear, I think, in Superintendent Johnson's voice is the anger around the fact that he was using, was specifically using racism and homophobia in order to garner sympathy and bolster his story and make it more credible. Like I said, if you look at the Charles Stewart hoax over who killed his wife, he was using racism to bolster his credibility because everyone would believe that a black person had killed his white wife. So hoaxers use what they have at their disposal.
Yep.
And if, in fact, he also sent, you know, the letter to the set of Empire, that tells me that it was a hoax being perpetrated in stages, which definitely makes it worse. I am not, you know, I think this is absolutely horrible and horrific. I also try to temper that with the fact that we, you know, everybody is spending a little bit too much time talking about him and not enough talking about this Coast Guard guy who planned on murdering everybody that he on the face of the earth. But, you know, that said, he's the topic that, you know, Smollett is a topic that we're on now.
By the way, it was the first topic we discussed with Chuck Todd this morning, just so you know.
Yeah, no, I heard that. I was actually in the green room, so I did hear it.
So for people that don't
know. We should be petrified that guy Hassan has lots of friends, because I think he has lots of friends and they have lots of guns.
Well, this was talking about this white supremacist who had stockpiled all this ammunition. You look at the picture on it. I mean, it was guns and guns and rifles and high-powered weaponry. And he had a list of politicians, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, a bunch of other people, and some TV people that he viewed to be too hostile toward the president, like Don Lemon on CNN.
Joe Scarborough.
Chris Hayes, even.
Yeah, Cuomo on CNN and people on MSNBC, which is really frightening. I mean, obviously, we do not devote enough time to white supremacy problems.
Yeah.
Can I say one more thing about the Smollett thing? I'm almost ready to declare defeat on the public camera issue. You know, years and years ago, Marjorie and I used to talk about how appalled I was that if you're in London, you were likely caught on a camera. I forget the precise number, but something like 350 times a day. Well, London has come to America, and you shoved that back at me when that young woman.
That woman was found in Charlestown in the guy's apartment, and they found her by means of a camera. Also, her ping on her cell phone. Right. Remember, she was abducted by this guy that had many problems, and it could have turned out horribly.
Well, and that's the Sarnaevs.
Right.
Sarnaevs,
of course. Same thing.
Well, that was not,
right.
But that was a private business camera, if
right.
I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yes.
And here, the first sign to police and others that there may be some holes in the Smollett story was the fact that not what they saw, but what they didn't see
right.
on the endless number of public cameras in Chicago. You know what the only part of, you know, while it is factually true that obviously this creates problems for the vast majority of people who are legitimate victims of serious crimes like Smollett suggested he was.
Or racist attacks.
Yeah, and we've had lived through this before, whether it's, you know, the lacrosse team at Duke? Where was the lacrosse?
Duke
years ago, or this situation. But it grown-ups can deal with that. Grown-ups can deal with that if this guy's the fraud that he appears to be, he's a fraud, but it doesn't mean that the vast majority of people who are in these circumstances are not telling the truth.
I completely agree with that, and I always sort of bristle a little bit when people say that because one person did this, then the consequences of that one person's
right.
behavior follow for the whole
forever.
Group. That is actually a form of racism, the inability to fail as an individual versus being part of your race
right.
or your
yeah.
gender or your sexual orientation is clear evidence. It's clear. It clearly indicates that you are not, if there's a supremacy of a race in your society, you're not in it. The fact that you cannot fail as an individual. And so I really kind of hate it when people say this. People should take this as it is. It is singular. It is horrible. I don't know, you know, how he kind of goes forward after something like this. And I'll tell you, I mean, part of it, the first thing I was struck by was just sort of the narcissism around it. And then I went back and I looked up the DUI he had in 2007. And
oh.
he was charged with providing false information to the police, mm-hmm. and it's reported that he gave a fake name, but it wasn't just a fake name.
Oh,
it was his brother Jake's name.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's something about that really bothers me, that it's not just some name you pull out of the air or somebody that you don't, you know, some stranger or whatever. He actually used his brother's name there. And I just, you know, this is such an incredibly talented family, the Smollett family. By the way, I was just saying it to Jason Turetsky. If you've never seen Eve's Bayou,
Jason.
You have got to see the movie Eve's Bayou. It's directed by Cassie Lemons. It says Journey Smollett and Jake Smollett, the brother whose name he used in it. But it's a beautiful movie. Anyway, that's what I thought was that. That was a sign of a level of narcissism that I found disturbing.
Well, I know you're not a psychiatrist, and
but
the reason I mentioned the Czech thing before is because obviously he's a smart guy, talented guy. It just surprises me that you would do this in such a ham-handed fashion, I guess. And I just wondered, as a prosecutor, as a sheriff, if you saw people like this that write a check?
Yeah, most people get caught because they're bad at it. I mean,
you'd think he'd be better at it, wouldn't you think?
Well, I think he didn't. He probably wasn't thinking that once he identified the perpetrators as Trump supporters, that anyone would be looking for two Nigerian brothers. He may have been unaware of the camera that was there that caught them, although they appeared to be covered head to toe. I don't know how you would be able to tell the race of either one of them just from the stills I saw, but maybe there were better pictures that weren't released to the public. But having an idea and in your mind how you think it's going to play out and being perfect in the execution of it is probably the history of less than 1% of all crimes
yeah.
that are ever committed. Execution is what trips people up. I mean, like a conspiracy. If you and one other person know what it is that you're up to, well, there you go. You're halfway down the road to getting caught.
You know something? I don't even know why I asked that question, because now that I'm thinking about it, there was this great case of this doctor, this Dirk Greiner, who was world-famous anesthesiologist asthma specialist.
Asthma
specialist with
on
children.
On that path. Rick Grundy's case.
Yeah.
Rick Grundy was a prosecutor.
And
for
this is a great story. It's not a great story. The poor woman was murdered. But how he buys the murder weapons at this local Wellesley hardware store, takes her out with the dogs on a path that people...
German
shepherds. And he required that she give the dogs all commands in German, which is another really weird
thing.
But anyway, and he stabs her to death on this open trail that people in Wells are walking by all the time. Of course, somebody comes upon the body very soon. If you'd think that this guy, Mr. World-renowned asthma specialist, would have plotted things.
Yeah, people are not particularly adept at this, which I guess is a good thing. And the ones that are very good at it get away with what they're doing for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know what's another good thing? When the Supreme Court of the United States has a unanimous decision, maybe that's not true all the time, but in this era of grotesque partisanship in every part of life and 5-4 decisions that change the world, 9-zip is another good thing. It was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right.
Some of us were worried
she's
she
back.
Wouldn't be writing anymore.
RBG is back.
Can you explain in English for us what the decision was and the significance of them cutting back on the right to seize the property of evildoers by local police departments? What's the impact of
that? What would you do if you asked me those questions and I said no? I can't explain anything.
Well, that actually,
just,
you know, this
is
a rare
circumstance.
No, I actually almost understand it myself.
No,
but I
don't
think I do understand
it
as well.
It is.
As you.
It's about civil forfeiture. Civil forfeiture, for people who don't know, essentially enables the government through law enforcement to confiscate the property of people who are charged with crimes.
Charged,
not convicted.
Exactly.
As the proceeds of those crimes, or the proceeds of ill-gotten gains, acquired as a result of those crimes. I've always been surprised that this was never challenged on a massive, massive scale. And so what the Supreme Court did was essentially looked at it as was the Supreme Court 14th Amendment?
14th Amendment.
14th Amendment, yeah. A due process violation, the deprivation of property without due process, which is on its face what civil forfeiture is. It's the deprivation of a person's property without giving them sort of a hearing to prove that or an adequate opportunity to prove that it ought not to be taken.
Well, they also rely on excessive fine language, too.
And excessive in the Eighth Amendment, I
right.
think. Right.
I'm not sure if it's the Eighth, but the whole notion being that somebody is accused of, let's say, selling $120
right.
in drugs, and their parents, it was in your parents'
yes,
house,
40,
your parents' house
right.
is seized.
So the full value
and
of the
actually,
house is what's
that
taken.
Actually happened, and
I know
it was
it
only
did.
$40
right.
worth of drugs.
Right.
It
no,
took,
and
took
the reason it's
home.
So
the
they
reason
didn't
it
declare,
went rogue.
But they didn't say that civil forfeiture in and of itself is unconstitutional.
Right.
The excessive nature of
right.
some forfeiture is unconstitutional. Is
yes.
that not right?
And I wish they had gone further to do it, but I think because they were doing it under the due process clause, then that just means that the state has to provide adequate process before they take it. And even excessive fines, the prohibition is on excessive. It doesn't mean that mm-hmm. you can't fine. They're recognizing that there's a balance, that you could legitimately acquire the proceeds of a crime, and that would be appropriate for the government to confiscate those, and that you can legitimately fine people as long as it's not excessive. But the part of the reason it's gone rogue is that in the tenacity of elected officials determined never to say the words, "I'm going to raise your taxes," police departments, sheriff's departments, government agencies that can operate somewhat a little bit independently are looking to other sources. The trial court looks to other sources
yeah.
of revenue and then comes to rely on those sources of revenue. So they step up their forfeiture or they step up the collection of fines from people who are indigent. And that's how you have a system that is essentially a private taxation system for people who run afoul of the law.
Well, that was the Ferguson deal, was it not?
Right,
part
that's
of
exactly
what was found
what it
in
was.
Ferguson.
You exactly.
Know, but, you know, there's a for the non-Ferguson police forces who are not doing things that are not, forget, found to be illegal, at least up front, but are clearly confiscatory and discriminatory and all those sort of things.
That's a great word, by
but
the way.
What, which one?
It
I love
great.
That.
That is
it's
a
funny.
Great
I love
word.
That word, too.
Yeah.
But there are, what
it's
I read,
fun to say,
what
too.
I read in a New York Times story, following up on what you said a minute ago, Andrea Cabral, is there a lot of police departments before this decision by the Supreme Court thought what they were doing was constitutionally permissible, and a huge, I think it's Philly or one of the major police departments,
yeah.
20%
oh,
of their
yeah.
total budget
that's right.
comes from civil forfeiture.
That's right.
So the impact of this decision
huge.
Is huge on
right.
policing for those of us who would like to stay safe in our communities, right?
Right. I think what's going to happen there is there are going to have to be some policy shifts. Now that the Supreme Court has made this ruling, people should expect there to be challenges at the local level, at the state level, to the confiscatory policies of the police and their practices. So it will definitely have a ripple effect. I think that the states will end up having that law enforcement in individual states will have to become far more circumspect because it's questionable whether or not they would survive a challenge. And the state is going to have to come up with an answer to the due process violation that's just inherent in the nature of civil forfeiture. There's got to be a process that that allows the person to never have the property actually taken permanently. So we'll see what happens. But this is like every SCOTUS ruling. This has a significant ripple effect downstate.
We're talking to Andrew Cabral.
So we've talked to you about this before, Andrew Cabral, that people that have domestic violence problems in some cases go on to have mass shooting problems as well. Omar Mateen, the guy from the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Robert Louis Deere, the alleged 2015 Planned Parenthood shooter. I'm reading this from Vox. I did a whole piece about this. And now, most recently, this Gary Martin, the guy who went into this his workplace, his former workplace in Aurora, Illinois last week. And
can I add one thing to this? Wendy Murphy, our friend, texted me right after that and said other mass shootings the same week as Aurora in Minnesota and Mississippi, there was a domestic violence preceding it.
Yep.
So this is, you don't have to go as far back as Orlando and places like that.
So I guess the question is, are we doing something wrong here in terms of domestic violence prosecutions or classes or incarcerations or what?
Or not taking it seriously enough that there are clear and plain laws on the books that prohibit the owning of a firearm. Certainly while such charges are pending, I mean, here you can file for a 209A restraining order, and a judge can order as a part of that restraining order that you have to confiscate any guns that you currently own. But
Is that ordinarily part of such a restraining order?
Or? In a 209A, it is.
It is,
yes.
Okay.
But that's in Massachusetts. We have the strictest gun laws, right. You know, in the country, okay. And we have the lowest number of gun deaths as a result. But that is by no means a nationwide requirement. And what happened in this particular case with Martin is he had a felony violent conviction, assault and battery, dangerous weapon or something like that from 1995.
Mississippi, now, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know when he acquired this gun, but if he acquired it just before this happened, then he was close to that being a 20-year-old felony charge. I noticed in Vox, though, is Vox doesn't say that he was convicted. It says he had two relatively recent
charges.
Restraining order violations and a charge of stalking. But they only refer to it as charges. And the felony was a charge as well. It is not referred to, I don't think, as a conviction.
No, the felony was
a
conviction. Domestic
conviction,
violence
but maybe nearly 20 years old.
Yeah.
He didn't ping on the background check.
No,
when
ping on the background
and
check.
And I can't tell because it doesn't say whether or not the background check that was done checked fingerprints. Or went through the NCIC, which is essentially the FBI database. I'm not sure what was done there or why it didn't come back, and we may learn that in the days to come. But he was allowed to legally purchase this firearm, and that's a firearm he used to shoot those people.
Well, the Vox does point out that he applied for a concealed carry permit.
That's how they, yeah.
And the cops rejected his application, saying he had to voluntarily surrender his firearm. But he didn't.
He didn't. Right.
So that's
and
already.
He didn't, and they never confiscated.
Yes.
He already owned it, right? So that means he passed the background check to actually own the gun. He then wants to apply to conceal it from other people when he carries it on the street. That gets the police's attention. They deny it, and then, as Jim said, they don't follow up to actually confiscate the gun. So the only consequence to him is that he doesn't have his concealed carry permit, but he still has the gun.
Right, and that was the same gun he used in the attack against his former coworkers.
Yes.
But it
so
seemed
it
to me your first – I thought your first question, Marjorie, to get back to it, I thought around domestic violence.
Right. Oh,
is,
yes.
You know, there's a space between committing domestic violence and then going out and becoming a mass shooter. I thought your question was, what should we be doing in the middle there? Because it seems to me that purely saying you shouldn't be able to have a gun, that's a nice thing, particularly if it's enforced, is not enough. This is a horrible choice of words. Should the domestic violence charges and or convictions trigger something more than they do? What should they?
Well, first, I think you need to have, and there is a growing body of actual research and data, right? From even from what's out there. There's a clear connection. There's an anecdotal connection and a scientific connection between these two things. And that's why I said maybe take it more seriously. In other words, consider it when assessing dangerousness, somebody's application for a gun permit. Assess it in terms of a person's suitability to do more than just be in a relationship or answer to actual criminal charges. It's behavior that is indicative of other things. We use behavior that's indicative of other things all the time to make an assessment about a person's suitability or qualification to be allowed to do one thing or another. This is no different. And this is a pretty straight line. And I agree with you, Jim. Not everybody who engages in domestic violence is going to pick up a gun and shoot. But there is a remarkably high percentage of mass shooters. And we're now at, like, you know, sometimes one in two a day in this country. It's just a ridiculous, ridiculous number of mass shootings with no response on gun control. That line is just way too strong for that kind of behavior to not be scrutinized as presenting a much greater danger than we've been taking it, both in the courts and outside the courts.
Talking to Andrew Cabral.
So I wanted to ask you about Clarence Thomas and this libel case. Back in 64, here's the way it works now. If you're a regular person and somebody says something horrible about you, it's easier for you to get a conviction because you're a private citizen.
Sue them for defamation or libel.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're a public figure like the president
like
of the United States.
Like you were sued when you had the wrong guy peeing on the building.
I made a terrible mistake when I was at the Boston Herald. Yeah, it was awful. I was in trial for a week. And I made a mistake.
Accused somebody of urinating on a building. It was the wrong person.
It was the son and not the father who did it. It was the same name.
She lost. She had to pay a dollar.
It was a junior instead of the third. And I was on the witness stand for 2 days. It was the worst day, 2 days of my life. Let me tell you.
Oh, you printed it. You printed
yes.
the paper.
I made a bad mistake.
But that's not malice.
No, it's not.
Well, they only awarded a dollar.
It's not malice. Right. And but anyway, the guy said he was embarrassed and so forth and so on. So he sued me. But
because I'm not embarrassed to have for people to know that my son is urinating on the side of a building.
I know that was sort of the strange thing about
it. Can't pick your kids.
It was right in the middle of the Iran-Contra hearings too, and he brought in his children, and one of them was a Marine, and the other one was 9 months pregnant.
Oh,
and,
yikes!
Yeah, I mean, I'd ruined his life.
Yeah.
Anyway. That was tough after that. But you know something? I will blame the police a little bit for this because at least, in those days, and this would have been like the 1980s, when you called the police, oftentimes, the police didn't want to give you their name. You know, they just tell you something over the phone and you didn't have time to get to the courts. They're much better now than they used to be. Anyway, I'm off topic. So if you sue someone, if you say something terrible about like Donald Trump, who's a public figure, or you're a public figure, Andrew Cabral is a former sheriff.
I have wanted to sue many, many a media outlet over the course of my life.
So Clarence Thomas, I don't know if he's inspired by the president constantly ranting about this or what, but he now wants to change this to make it harder to sue a public figure, which does not seem like a good idea to me.
By the way, the case that we should just say, New York Times versus Sullivan is the name of the case that he and Trump have a problem with.
Right.
Right. He wants to make it easier for a public figure to sue a media outlet by removing the requirement, and this is the biggest hurdle that anybody has to jump over, of actual malice. So if you're a public figure and someone says something terrible about you, you would have to, in order to successfully sue them, you would have to prove that the media outlet or whoever it is acted with actual malice. It perhaps should not be as high a bar, generally speaking, as it is. But the reason that it's such a high bar is because the fundamental role of the press, at least historically, they may have gotten away from it a little bit now, but at least historically, is to speak truth to power. And that you have to have the freedom to do that. A free and unfettered press is always going to be the right choice, no matter how difficult it might be for a public figure to sue. I'm sure there's also something about, you know, people who are public figures enjoy a certain amount of fame and what comes with that and the sort of a presumptive credibility around some of the things that they say. But, you know, I'm not sure where Thomas is siding or if he's who he's siding with on this. I am automatically, I'll confess, suspect or suspicious of his motivations for doing it. He just says that it's an antiquated rule and it's time that it's changed. He doesn't offer, I think, the kind of balancing test that a Supreme Court justice should have engaged in their written concurrence about what would be lost if the malice component was no longer required and the chilling effect that that would have on the press's ability to speak truth to power or willingness to speak truth to power, because every decision would be a financial one. I think he could have engaged in a better balancing test for that. But it doesn't surprise me that it's not there.
Yeah, you wonder, too, whether, I mean, people have said some pretty dastardly things about him.
And his wife.
And his wife.
Yeah.
And maybe
It's usually, I think with him, it's usually kind of personal, a little bit personal.
Okay, Andrea Cabral.
All right.
Andrea Cabral, thank you. Thank you very much, Andrea Cabral.
You're very welcome.
Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. Andrea Cabral is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety and the current CEO of Ascend. Up next, how the Run DMC and Aerosmith mashup became a major pop culture moment. Jeff Edgers joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. So is Aerosmith the Trojan horse for hip-hop? One that gave it the legs to leave all other genres in the dust and reign supreme? Was the Aerosmith Run DMC mashup of Walk This Way the game changer that a new book suggests it was? The book is called Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the song that changed American music forever. By Jeff Edgers. Jeff is the National Arts Editor for the Washington Post. Jeff, it's great to see you. Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, congratulations to you. So explain to people that are like kind of dopes about music and music history like I am.
You're not a dope. Come on. You know everything about it.
No,
come on.
Yeah, I don't really at all. I know nothing. So tell us the premise of your book.
Well, it's it's a very heavily reported history of this moment, but the reason the moment's important is because Walk This Way, which was originally an Aerosmith song and then was covered by Run DMC, when that song came out on July 4th, 1986, it completely changed popular culture. And, you know, that could sound like hyperbole, but I can tell you in like 25 seconds why, which is you had rap and hip-hop played on college radio stations and in clubs, but it was not part of our regular society. And today, when it's everywhere, I mean, rappers win Pulitzer Prizes, and it's the clothing, and it's on TV, it's pervasive, it's everything. It might be hard to believe that, but that's the first song, the first rap song that was played on mainstream radio and played on MTV, really, in wide circulation. So,
and can you like set the scene here a little bit? I made the mistake before I read your book. You were on TV with me a week or two ago. I assumed that Aerosmith was reigning supreme. I couldn't believe that they sort of deigned to do this kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, I realized this was not exactly an uptime for the local band. Tell us what the state of Aerosmith was in the mid-80s when this thing happened.
Well, I'm from here, so I saw Aerosmith play when I was 13 years old, the Worcester Centrum, the Back in the Saddle tour. But I was 13, I didn't really know about medicine that adults took. So I didn't really understand what was actually going on. And, you know, Aerosmith had been huge in the 70s. They were playing 80,000-seat festivals, the Texas Jam. They had everybody opening up for them. But in 1979, Joe Perry and Tyler got into an argument, and Perry quit. And Aerosmith, like, labored on. They made one record without Joe Perry, which was Murder to Make. And then Joe Perry, you know, had a succession of versions of his solo band that just got worse and worse and worse. I mean, by the end of, like, 1983, he was touring around in, like, Jonathan Edwards' borrowed van. And his bandmates were, like, trying to keep him awake. I mean, it was really, really grim. They get back together again. They make a comeback record in 1985 called Done With Mirrors, and it bombs. And that record is famous to me because, first of all, it's Done With Mirrors. Who would come up with that idea if you were all into drugs? It seems crazy. But also, all the type on that record was backwards. Like, even, like, the little credits, I remember, you'd have to put it up to a mirror, and, you know, who does that? So they were coming to the game really on the outs, seen as sort of like jokes. And Run DMC, on the other hand, they were rising. They were maybe not as popular as, say, Aha or Starship. You know them? Remember that? No.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah,
actually.
There we go.
Take me a minute.
Well, you should know, Marjorie. The leader of Aha is maybe the best-looking male singer in the history of the planet, but that's the topic.
And he's from Norway. He has excellent
healthcare.
He is
Norway. That's correct. That is correct.
But he, you know, that moment, Run DMC were the only rap superstars. I mean, they weren't selling like those big pop stars, but they were selling like a million records when they would put stuff out.
And so, by the way, how much money, this is my favorite, of all the great anecdotes in this book, how much money did the huge Aerosmith get to come down? Where was it, New York? Where was this thing?
It was done in New York, and it was on an off day. They were touring. They left their tour. They just played a gig with Ted Nugent opening up. And
whatever happened to him?
I don't know. They went in, and they were paid $8,000, Joe Perry and Steven Tyler, to record that day.
You know,
and
here's
also,
here's some,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Explain that. We want to talk about this whole scene of the video that we saw.
Well,
morning.
We'll talk about the scene in a minute, but I want to talk about what, coming into this thing about the love or lack of love or knowledge of one set of guys for another. Here's DMC in an interview with VH1 saying he had no idea who Aerosmith was when the group was first approached with the for the collaboration. Here it is.
Walk This Way by Aerosmith, which we did not know was the name of the record, or we didn't know the name of that band. All we knew was Toys in the Attics. All the DJs would scratch out the name and the title and everything so nobody could look and see, what's that beat?
So did Aerosmith have any idea about Run DMC when this collaboration was about to happen?
Well, Joe Perry had just gotten remarried, and his 13-year-old stepson, Aaron, told me that he brought him like into his room and showed him some of his tapes, like Dougie Fresh and Run DMC and Houdini. So he may have had some knowledge. I don't know what Tyler knew. I mean, Tyler told me that when he was like buying drugs in New York in the early 80s, he would buy tapes from guys out there. And so he got familiar with some of that stuff. But I don't know. I will say that in the reporting of this, I was able to acquire this almost 20-minute long video document of that day that MTV took and then put in their vaults and never showed anyone. They showed like 90 seconds of it. And you watch these two groups interacting. You watch Tyler and Perry on one side and Run DMC on the other. And they are, that's the video.
Okay, the video.
I'm talking
okay.
about, this is actually March 9th, 1986 in the studio when they're recording.
Sorry.
And it's fascinating because they're pretending to know each other. So when people say, like, what do you think of these guys? They're like, oh, yeah, they're my favorites. But you can look in their eyes and you can tell from the way they're explaining it that they really don't know much about each other. And in the fact, Run DMC really doesn't like Aerosmith. That's not their thing.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of it, obviously the Aerosmith connection for local folks is a big deal. But the other local connection that I love, every year right before Christmas, we get to spend 20 minutes with Oedipus, the legendary Oedipus of WBCN fame, as he does this incredible Christmas Eve thing. It used to be done elsewhere. It's now done 6 hours on Christmas Eve here. What does he have? What does he say? He has a glass of wine, a candle, and himself sitting in a room doing 6 hours of the best music
that you've never heard before.
Most of it you've never heard before. Explain Oedipus's role in this transformation.
Well, Oedipus was a really, really, and is an important figure in all this music. I mean, when he was at MIT's radio station, he was breaking groups like the Sex Pistols and the Ramones in ways that nobody else was. And when he took over BCN, he was just as innovative as a programmer. but he was also a gatekeeper. And so in 1986, if you were on mainstream radio programming, you did not have rap. The black stars you had would be like Lionel Richie or Michael Jackson, more likely.
Because they were safe.
Well, it wasn't that they were safe. They fit the format, which was rock radio. Mm-hmm. When MTV is launched in 1981, they put a flag, you know, with Neil Armstrong, and they say, welcome, you know, rock music. I'm not quoting it exactly, but they say rock music. And that's what the format was. And everybody in radio, you know, not you guys, of course, but at that time, they're like followers, you know, lemmings. And so they're looking at WBCN as one of the key radio stations, and they want to follow the leader. So when that song came into WBCN and they saw the hometown guys, Tyler and Perry, on it, they said, we can put that on the radio. And they did. And everybody else followed. And then MTV followed. And so that is how everything shifted.
So this music-changing moment, is, and you also contend it's a society-changing moment. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Not only would it not have happened, at least not have happened as quickly, were it not for this moment in New York, it might not have happened had Oedipus not done what he did. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, theoretically, somebody else could have done that, but all the factors were in place for it to happen here in Boston because Aerosmith happened to be the hometown, but even on their lowest point, Aerosmith was still revered here. And, you know, their DJs loved Aerosmith and were going to put him on. So, no, I mean, it could have happened, maybe. I don't know. But all the factors were perfect for Oedipus to make that decision.
So when you talk about Aerosmith, you know, how they had been playing these massive stadiums and then things went downhill. Was that about drugs or what was that about?
Well, I think it was about a lot of things, but it was also, you know, I mean, they were really on drugs. I mean, when I say that, I mean, you know, Steven Tyler was living in a hotel room with, like, his stuff, like, in twine, like, in cardboard boxes. They were on, like, these very, very limited allowances. Joe Perry was going bankrupt and, you know, couldn't get a record deal. So, you know, the greatest American band of the 1970s, the most popular certainly were almost non-functional. And then, you know, the
what
other
kind
thing
of drugs?
I mean, I think they would do, you know, like Joe Perry described, like reaching his pocket and finding some powders, or, you know, they would grind up anything. I mean, they would do anything, really. They were just, the thing that brought them together was drugs. I mean, I think cocaine was a big deal. So I think just, you know, it was pervasive. I mean, I talked to Ted Templeman, who produced their 85 record, Done with Mirrors, and really was famous for producing all of Van Halen and finding them. And he just describes this culture. I don't remember it because, again, I was just a kid. But he'd be sitting at a restaurant with Michael McDonald of the Doobie Brothers, and they would just put cocaine on the table and start snorting it. It's like insane to me. And I'm glad that I was able to get Michael McDonald snorting cocaine into my book. I think that's no small thing.
Marjorie just wants to be sure he was not snorting his father, like Keith Richard was allegedly doing.
That's right. That's right.
But, you know, the Rolling Stones, there's a dynamic, a brotherly tension, a hate. You know, the Rolling Stones are who they are because of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, the Kinks because of Ray and Dave Davies. You can go on and on down the line. Take out an element and the chemistry is not the same.
Yeah, okay. And then, but so when they did do this song together, and it was played on the radio, and it changed the world in terms of rap music, but it changed things for Aerosmith too, right?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things in this book, and it's a reason I talked to like 100 people. I want to reframe things that have been, I think, created as myth. And that's why you go back to these people and ask them the same questions they've answered before, but you really press them. And the fact is, there's this false idea out there that Aerosmith came along and helped this young group of black musicians and catapulted them. And yes, that song was the biggest hit that Run DMC would ever have. But I would argue that Run DMC saved Aerosmith in many ways. I mean, they, after this, they actually cleaned up. I mean, the song itself made Steven Tyler, you know, they needed to do an intervention, and they had to get him to the office early in the morning before he'd done drugs. And they used the song as an excuse. They said, the BBC wants to talk to you about Walk This Way. Can you get to the office early because of the time difference? And when he shows up, they're all there, like, we're intervening. So that's one way. But also, it taught Aerosmith to listen to other people and not be so insular and, like, take advice and use other songwriters. A lot of people actually don't like the Aerosmith that emerged out of that. because they felt like they were kind of slick and glossy, you know, permanent vacation, dude looks like a lady. But they were more popular than they were before.
Yeah.
It really relaunched them.
Hey, by the way, the name of the book, that's Jeff Edgers. The name of the book is Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. We keep referring to Aerosmith, but don't I remember, I didn't, when I read the book, it was a couple of weeks ago when you were on TV, so correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't all the rest of the band not there? Wasn't it just Perry and Tyler? Was that not what happened?
No, you're right. And, you know, I talked to John Kolodner, who was the record executive who had Aerosmith on. He's kind of a famous guy. And he was very dismissive of the other three guys in Aerosmith. Brad Whitford, the guitarist, Tom Hamilton, the bassist, and Joey Kramer, the drummer.
Tom Hamilton, who does band in Boston every single year, I should say, Marjorie, again, that's right. To his credit. Yes, go ahead.
And a great, you know, great musicians. And he used to call them the LI3, less important three.
Oh, Jesus.
I actually, when I wrote the story for the Post, Marty Baron told me I will never refer to you as one of the LI3. I was like, well, that's why I came here. It's unclear exactly what happened in the moment. Kolodner will tell you that the other three guys were very resistant and said, I don't like this and I don't want to do it. I spoke to those guys, you know, now, and they say they felt left out. Like, it was sort of sad. They felt like they weren't part of the mix. And, you know, you referenced, Marjorie, the video, which is quite famous. There's an Aerosmith in that video, but not really. They actually hired these three guys in New York from a band called Smashing Gladys to pretend they were Aerosmith. And just to show you how obsessive I am, I actually talked to them. But they were like sort of blurry in the background. And there was some tension there because Tyler was nervous that that the real guys would be, their feelings would be hurt. So he didn't want them to be seen too closely.
By the way, the all three members of Smashing Gladys are now actuarial accountants, actually, somewhere in Queens. Hey, you know, we're talking to
Jeff Edgers.
I know who he is. We're talking to Jeff Edgers. You make the claim, not just that this changed music, that this changed society, which some suggest is a tad hyperbolic. You want to make the case?
Well, yeah, it's pretty easy for me to make the case because I'm making it. But, you know, right, you got to remember there was no hip hop played on mainstream radio or MTV. That's one thing. But then you even get out of music and you think about some of the TV shows that emerged, like In Living Color, Arsenio, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I found in the archives at Cornell, right next to the Gettysburg Address, is a script that Run-DMC's record company wrote to the Cosby producers in 1985, asking them to incorporate Run-DMC into a show, because they would have, like, Stevie Wonder on, and, you know, and they get this very straight form letter back basically saying, thank you so much for your interest. I mean, it was a full script. And they said, but we really don't see this music fitting in with our audience. So that tells you that it was completely outside of culture. In a year, everything was hip hop.
How thrilling is this for you? I mean, the last thing that I did with you was years ago when you did that incredible effort to reunite the Brothers and the Kinks,
yeah.
Which was just...
That didn't seem to work, though.
But, no, but it was like, isn't there a scene with you playing... Talk about you-know-whats. Isn't there a scene in that movie with you playing guitar in some hotel room with Sting? Am I right about that?
Yes, it angered some people. But like 70% of the people liked it and 25% hated it, and then 5% I didn't show.
Because they think you're an arrogant whatever.
Well, they're like, who's that guy? Like, exactly. I'm not very good at playing.
Well,
you know?
I thought it was pretty amazing. But how exciting is this to go back and to talk to all... the players. I mean, you made the comment, I can't believe I actually spoke to all three members of Smashing Gladys. Forget that, but all the key players in this incredibly important moment. Isn't that like unbelievably exciting for you beyond just being a great work project?
Well, just, yeah. I mean, remember, I'm 13 years old in 1984 in the Worcester Centrum watching Aerosmith, and then I'm at like Johnny Depp's house talking to Joe Perry about how he invented that riff in 1974 in Hawaii. It's a great gift that I'm allowed to go back, yeah, and basically interview my teenage heroes and then also get on their nerves and ask them questions they don't always want to answer. So yeah, I mean, how lucky can I be here?
Yeah, you've got a great anecdote about Joe Perry being shy. Tell people about that.
Well, Jack Douglas, who produced all the great Aerosmith albums in the 70s, Toys in the Attic and Rocks, he's just wonderful to talk to. And he has a whole psychological profile of those guys because Tyler and Perry have had so much tension over the years. And he describes Tyler as, it's not like he wants to actually be married to him, but he does want to be married to Perry. He wants him to be his work wife, I guess. And he's, you know, Steven Tallarico is exuberant and just over the board. And, you know, he calls me sometimes just randomly and yells at me, you know, that kind of thing. But Joe Perry is super quiet, almost bookish. And he says he's not really a rock star. Like he would, I think he describes him as like almost being a librarian if he hadn't done this as a rock star. And it's still like that today. That tension is still there.
Wow, how weird is that, huh? The guy that spent so much of his life in front of thousands and thousands of people.
I don't think it's that atypical, is it? I mean, Barbara Streisand has stage fright too, you know? Yeah. You know, by the way, just to show, when I asked you the question a minute ago, Jeff Edgers, about how thrilling it's got to be sitting down with these people. One of our producers, Arjun, says, I have one of Joe Perry's guitar straps. He left it at a guitar shop my old roommate worked at, and he gave it to me. So, I mean, they're all gradations of excitement about, you know, literally or figuratively touching these. It's unbelievable. In any case, Jeff, the book is great. It's huge, fun, and congratulations. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for coming in, Jeff. And congratulations again, and congratulations on your great job. It pains me to see people from the Globe going to the Washington Post, but that's the way it goes.
Yet another one,
that's right. Jeff Edgers is the National Arts Reporter for the aforementioned Washington Post. His new book, Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. Thank you very much.
See you, Jeff.
I'm a little bit confused here, Jim. I think we're not going to do Paul Revel next.
Or I don't think we are either.
Okay. Coming up, we're going to talk about a great book about the breakdown, basically, of fault lines in the United States of America from the late 60s right through Donald Trump in the 2019s. That is next. Fault Lines by Julian Zelizer with Kevin Krause.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Inside Marjorie promised you Julian Zelizer and his book Fault Lines, A History of the U.S. Since 1974. And you will get Julian Zelizer, but not quite yet. We're a little bit out of order. Joining us on the line now, though, to go over the latest education headlines is Paul Revel. Paul, as you know, is a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. And he's the former Secretary of Education from Massachusetts. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, how are you?
Hey,
we're
terrific.
Good, thank you.
Great to talk to you, Paul. So let's start locally up on Beacon Hill. You know, a lot of talk all around the state about a need to increase school funding and a need to make even things out between the poor communities and the wealthier communities. The Senate President, Karen Spilka, has put a new guy in charge of education in the Senate. That's State Senator Jason Lewis, who's known to be a good negotiator and compromiser. Is this going to be a good thing for the schools?
Well, I mean, I think there was strong leadership there before. Sonia Chang-Diaz was certainly an education advocate and a former teacher. I do think that there was an impasse last summer between the Senate and House versions of a fix that's long overdue on Chapter 70. So getting new players at the table, I think, is a way of shaking things up and provides some hopefulness. I think Jason Lewis has a good reputation as somebody who can negotiate a deal. So let's see what happens. I think it's significant that the governor has already come forward in his budget and made this topic of Chapter 70 finance reform a top priority. And, you know, they almost got there last summer. So I'm hoping and predicting that there'll be a solution to this in the next few months.
Well, the criticism of Chang-Diaz, at least in the Globe editorial, was that she was all about let's have more money, but she didn't want any accountability. And that was seemed to be the you know, or new tools to change things, particularly in schools that were struggling.
Yeah, there is a kind of philosophical tension in this. There are those who feel that the fix to Chapter 70 is, you know, 15 or 20 years overdue, and this is money that was part of the last deal of money for accountability, and therefore should be paid just as an overdue debt. And then there are others who feel if we're going to spend this much more new money, you know, in excess of $1 billion as a Commonwealth on education, we should have some controls and some guarantees that the money will be well spent. And so there's been differences on that, and that's part of the reason, not the whole reason, but part of the reason it stalled out last time. I think there is a middle way where the Commonwealth certainly has an obligation to provide adequate funding to every district to educate each and every one of its children to a high level. Yet at the same time, if the Commonwealth is going to spend at unprecedented levels, I think the legislature has a right to ask for certain provisions that will assure that the money is well spent. Now, these might be categorical provisions where we say as a legislature that we'll give you this much more money, but it has to be spent in certain ways. Or on the other end, it might be accountability provisions. You can spend the money any way you want, but we're going to look for the following kinds of results. And if you don't get them, we're going to be more prescriptive. And that's where the negotiation would be.
Hey, Paul, this is a horrible connection. You're usually in the studio. If you can walk around a few feet while you're talking to us, it might be. Okay. You know, I don't mean to get lost in the weeds here, but this is an issue we've discussed with you almost every week or every 2 weeks you're here for years. And I have to say, I'm not nearly as hopeful as you are. I don't want to disparage at all Senator Lewis because he's been a leader on a lot of important things. He was the lead opponent of the marijuana ballot question. Is that not right, Marjorie? He was.
Yes, that's right.
And I remember
ideological, Jim.
I remember interviewing him and him saying, when I was asking him what the basis for his opposition was and the whole question of ballot question, saying, frankly, I could have I would have supported legalization. I don't like the content of this question. And I remember saying to him, so then why didn't you make a proposal for legalization that would have accommodated your concerns? And I don't remember what his answer was, but I worry here that not just Senator Lewis, but the legislature is ultimately going to decide this is too hard. Let's let the people make a decision. Because clearly, if the legislature fails yet again on this issue, there's going to be a ballot campaign. Is that not fairly obvious to you, Paul Revel?
Well, yeah, I think there'll be two things will happen, Jim. And one of them, I think, is going to keep the pressure on the legislature in the near term, which is a number of the cities that are most deeply affected by the unfairness of the current school financing approach are gathering together and organizing for a lawsuit against the Commonwealth. And there's every reason to believe such a lawsuit would be successful. And I think the pressure of this in the background is going to be a factor.
I hope so.
That will not let just a single leader get in the way of our finding a solution on this.
We are talking Paul Revel. Go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
Well, so I think that there are two pressure points here. One is a potential court case. The other is going directly to the ballot. But I'm more optimistic. I mean, the Globe, I think, pointed to the chair, and that was a reasonable thing to notice and to celebrate at some level. But I think the pressure overall, with the governor pushing this as a top priority of his, with enormous pressure mounting in the field to do something about this, with local cities and towns complaining bitterly over being shortchanged on this, I'm not sure the legislature is going to be able to avoid coming to some kind of a conclusion on this in the next few months.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education.
So, Paul Revel, there was a big story in the Globe about how METCO students outperform those in Boston public schools or charter schools. And I thought, is this a surprise? I think that it's if you're surrounded by other kids. Well, you're the education expert. Is this a surprise?
Why don't you explain what METCO is first
METCO,
the vast majority of people may not know.
To me, and I think
it... Oops.
Oh.
Okay, Paul, can you give us another, can you hang up and call us again, or we'll call you in about 30 seconds and see if this any better. We've got a rotten connection. You want to explain what the METCO program
is? METCO is if you're in Boston and you would like to go to a school in the suburbs, you can sign up for the METCO program, and that if you're a person of color, a kid of color, I should say, and that enables you
I don't think it's exclusively kids of color, is it? Or maybe you're right. Okay, go ahead.
That enables you to go to schools in Brookline or Wellesley or Dover or any number of other towns. And the reason this isn't surprising to me is because, you know, people that went to tough schools, and anybody that's gone to a tough school remember this, you weren't supposed to really be a smart kid. You know, there's a lot of pressure not to be a smart kid. And I always remember when my kids were lucky enough to go to the Brookline schools, where being smart was really encouraged and praised, and you didn't have to pretend, you know, you didn't have to hide your books under your desk or whatever. So the fact that, and there are parents that are very concerned about education, as people criticize the charter school parents for being very concerned about education and therefore penalize them when they want to get their kids in charter schools. The Metco kids' parents are probably also very concerned. That was the joke, that you got to sign your kid up for Metco when you're driving back from the hospital after the baby is born. But what are you laughing at?
I didn't know until I read this piece, obviously you did, that people start applying from the moment that their kid is born.
Yes.
Which is why the waiting list has 15,000 people on it.
Yes. And so when you go to schools that where the emphasis is, and you're surrounded by other kids who are very motivated, this is absolutely no surprise at all. So I don't even know in a way whether it is.
Well, but except the researchers from Harvard, and Paul may know them since they're Harvard connected, suggest that they don't reach conclusions as to why the numbers are as different as they are. They suggest that one reason may be you're sitting next to a kid who may be more aspirant. Well, that's common sense, but they haven't proven
totally
it.
It's totally obvious. Well, it just
it's obvious to me, too.
I mean, if you went to, you know, well, you went to the Quaker school, so maybe it was
for 4 years
different.
I went to
Quaker school. Schools in Fall River, which is not a, you know, where almost nobody went to college. And if you were a smart kid, you were best to hide it. You know, that was.
I understand
that. People got ridiculed. And I think that probably is the same thing.
So what's the takeaway for you, since you're not a former Secretary of Education, from the data here, what's the takeaway that is replicable or transferable to public? We were talking about public school reform with Jason Lewis being the new Senate chair.
Public schools, as you know, need to be radically reformed. And
well, what's the Metco lesson? That if you believe that the lesson of Metco and the success of its students are a function of who the students are surrounded by in these wealthier suburban public school systems, how does that translate at all?
The great tragedy of the Boston schools is that the vast majority of kids in the Boston schools are poor. And if the Boston schools
were... what are you going to do about that?
Well, you make it easier for people to come to want to go to the Boston public schools. Paul Revel's back on the phone.
Oh, he's back on the phone. Okay, Paul, welcome back.
I mean, you know, if everybody living in Jamaica Plain and West Roxbury went to the Boston public schools would be different.
You know, we were, Paul, while you were...
It makes the job for the Boston Public Schools a much bigger job than it is when you have kids who come in with all kinds of background advantages.
So, but
exactly, that's kind of one of the tragedies.
Wait. The only thing that matters about the Metco thing to me at all, as opposed to the story of abstract interest, it's sort of like how I feel about charter schools. If what happens good in a charter school is not replicable and transferable to the vast majority of kids in traditional public schools, then to me it's of no value. What's the lesson of Metco, these results in your mind, Paul Revel, that could be of value of a Boston public school kid or any urban public school kid who's not in a Metco program? Is there something that's transferable or usable or replicable?
Well, we do know that the integration of students from a socioeconomic standpoint, in other words, surrounding students with students of a variety of different backgrounds, different role models, different norms, is much superior when it comes to increasing the chances of low-income youth than concentrating those youth with only other low-income youth.
Mm-hmm.
So this study sort of bears out what we know from other research that tells us that. Having said that, I'm always a little skeptical of research like this because it is a bit like charter schools in a certain sense of what we call selection bias.
Meaning?
In other words, the number of people who pre-register their children at birth, which is what happens these days in Metco, and are stable for all that period of time, and then their children agree to ride a bus often 2 hours each way to get to school and be supported by their parents in doing that. This is a very small sort of subset of extremely highly motivated parents who don't have a lot of other distractions going on in their lives that get in the way of their being able to do that. And so naturally you're going to get higher levels of performance with that sort of selection bias in it. So you have to account for that. It's a bit like charter schools. Everybody says, well, anybody can enroll in charter schools, and it's a lottery. But the question is, who are the parents who decide to inform themselves about charter schools, sign up, go through the application process, and wait in the lottery to get in? It's not the same as a sample of all students. So there is a little bit of that bias. But I go
but
back
you know,
to what I said.
Paul,
you
Marjorie's head's
like
going to pop off.
You
there.
Are arguing against parents showing that kind of concern for the education of their children. That's kind of it drives me nuts.
I'm not arguing against it. I'm just saying you can't. You therefore have to understand the results in that light. In other words, you wouldn't necessarily say it's all about what's happening in the Western public schools that makes these kids perform at higher levels. It's something about, you know, the motivation and choice of parents
and determination. Paul, you know, there are many kids on waiting lists for charter schools in Boston that can't get in. So maybe we should look at how the children of those parents who wanted to get into charter schools and
want to get into Metco. That's a great idea. That's wonderful research.
Yeah,
that's an ideal study. And in fact, my colleague Tom Kane at Harvard has done such a study, and it's favorable to charter schools. When you control for this set of parents wanted to go but couldn't get in, and this decided to go and did get in, the charter school students still do better than those students who go back to the Boston public
schools. So what does that say?
Well, that says there's something going on in those schools that is superior in terms of educational performance. And we know that. I mean, we know we have some of the top charter schools in the country here in Boston. So there are things that are getting results that mainstream schools should be paying attention to.
We should move on because Marjorie's going to have a stroke, Paul. So
You know what one thing is important to point out, though?
We don't want that.
No, we do not.
That you see where the Democratic candidates for president are going.
What do you mean, vis-a-vis charter schools?
Barack Obama was much more into education reform.
Arne Duncan was a big charter school supporter.
Yes, he was. But I think that the Democrats are retreating, at least from what I've seen of the presidential candidates.
There's no question, Marjorie. I mean, you could see it in the last election. Hillary Clinton barely entered the K-12 space. She wanted to talk about early childhood or sometimes about higher ed. But because of the, the civil war that we have over charter schools, some Democrats love charter schools and feel that's a progressive direction to take in education. Others are with the unions and feel it's a threat to our democracy, and it's certainly a threat to the status quo in terms of the education system. So Democrats are deeply divided, and Republicans in their own way are divided about this as well. In some of our more rural middle American states, you know, the public schools don't want competition in these smaller rural communities. And so representatives of those towns are not in favor, even if they're Republicans, of the choice agenda that Betsy DeVos is putting forward. So both the major parties are divided on this issue and in consequence often avoid the whole K-12 sector altogether. And it's a problem.
You know, we only have a minute left, Paul. Before you go, I was reading Marjorie went to Smith when she was a kid, obviously. My older daughters, you know, went to Smith. And obviously, it's just down the road from Hampshire College, and we've all been reading the stories about them only taking so many freshmen. There's retrenchment. There are lots of layoffs that are coming. But I'm not that I don't mean to be unsympathetic to the plight of students and alum from Hampshire College, but it seems to be emblematic of the, I don't know if it's right to call it a crisis, in small, independent private colleges in Massachusetts. Can you end with a little Nostradamus work? Are we a decade or so away from massive consolidation or an end to these small? The conventional wisdom is that revenues are not anywhere near what they need to be for the vast majority of these small schools, at least in this part of the country. Is that a fair characterization?
It's certainly an accelerating trend, and so I don't see anything stopping it in the near future. I mean, it isn't massive because these institutions don't serve massive numbers. We happen to have a higher proportion of them in our area than in some other parts of the country, so it seems overwhelming because of the sheer numbers. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the size of the schools involved, Newberry College or Mount Ida or Hampshire, these are all small institutions. So we know that the small private institutions operating on a very tuition-heavy revenue model are just having real trouble attracting students. And with the demographics at that age going down steadily over the next decade, they're going to be in even deeper trouble. So they're going to have to look to consolidate or totally reinvent themselves, and many have been trying to do that and failing at it. So you'll see some consolidation toward larger institutions, toward the larger public institutions. It's all part of the general affordability crisis that exists in higher education generally in the country.
Paul, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Paul Revel.
No
problem.
Problems.
Don't worry about it.
Paul joins us regularly. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Lab. That is Paul Revel, of course. Coming up, a new book looks at the origins of how we got to be such a polarized nation in 2019. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She's Marjorie Egan. Poll after poll after poll finds that America is divided. We're divided on whether the Mueller investigation will prove Russia tried to interfere in the 2016 election. We're divided on gun control, on Colin Kaepernick, on whether the U.S. should be isolationist or interventionist. And a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll finds the only thing we're not divided on is that we're divided. We're a country split between two competing realities. How we got there is the subject of the new book. It's called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. We're joined by Julian Zelizer. He co-authored Fault Lines with Kevin Cruz. Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, CNN political analyst, and you can catch him tonight at the fabulous Massachusetts Historical Society at 6 o'clock. Julian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jim just sort of explained the premise of your book a little bit, but elaborate on it.
Yeah, we're looking at the different divisions that have defined the country since the 1970s, the political divisions between the parties where the centers eroded, the economic divisions between the rich and the poor, and the fragile middle class, the racial divisions that never really went away after the 1960s and in some ways intensified, and finally divisions over sexuality and gender issues. And we're just telling the history, but those are the themes that overlay the story.
And what are the common threads? I mean, among the common threads are the I wouldn't say the demise, but the collapse, the retrenchment of some of the institutions that prevented these fault lines from happening, like you mentioned, like unions, like a fair media, like an activist federal government. But are there common threads, Julian, through these fault lines through the decades?
Yeah, well, we argue the period before, that was what was different. It wasn't as if everyone agreed in the 40s to the 60s. There were institutions that held us together. So unions are a great example. They were a thread that held different parts of society.
Thread, not a threat.
Right,
thread.
A thread. A thread.
Okay,
no,
fine.
A thread.
Thank you.
That different parts of our society depended on for the entrance into the middle class. The manufacturing-based economy that they were part of, you know, gave economic benefits to a large portion of the nation. The federal government was an important presence in that period, and that would weaken after the 1960s. The media is a big one that we talk about. You know, before the 70s, there were only a handful of institutions that people turned to for news, handful of networks, handful of city papers that really defined what the debate was about. And we trace that since that time, it has fragmented, fractured, and become this wild west of information that fuels a lot of our polarization.
Well, you know, Julian, we were going to try to be polite and talk about the general themes in your book for 10 minutes or so. And then we were going to focus right on Chapter 7 and changing channels. But
sure,
since you did, let's work backwards for a minute. Can you describe to people what the Fairness Doctrine was, what it was intended to do, what it did do, and what the consequence of its disappearance has done?
Yeah, we had this rule that the Federal Communications Commission had in place from 1949 to 1987. It basically said if you were a television station or a radio network and you presented a political view, you had to present the other political view as well. You couldn't just do one. And if you didn't do it, you could end up in a lawsuit. So it was a source of pressure for producers to make sure that their shows weren't simply overtly partisan. It didn't always work, but it was in place and people thought about it. Many conservatives by the 80s didn't like it, including Ronald Reagan. They thought it was biased toward liberals. Liberals controlled the networks and the newspapers. And under Reagan, the FCC does away with it. So what's the effect? After that, stations could put on whatever they wanted. And right after the Fairness Doctrine is dismantled, you see the proliferation of conservative talk radio. This is the Rush Limbaugh era leading into Fox News.
What are the numbers? You cite numbers, don't you, about talk radio stations pre-disappearance of the Fairness Doctrine?
I don't remember the number. It's 87 to 92 that you have the boom. The numbers are in the book,
here
but it's dramatic.
In one of these stories, in 1960, there were only two all-talk radio stations in America. 35 years later, in 1995, there were 1,130. Right. And you talk about you know, people like Rush Limbaugh, Bob Grant from New York City.
One of the most disgusting creatures.
Yeah,
I lived in New York for some of
him. Oh, he was very, very, very racist. And
he changes after the doctrine's gone. You can listen to his shows. He was always very polemical, but after the doctrine, his language really goes off the rails.
And people like Rush Limbaugh and Bob Grant, many people would argue, of course, are not journalists, they're entertainers, but people don't necessarily realize that.
Right. So they became part of the news ecosystem, and that's how they were heard, and Fox legitimates that. But in addition to the Fairness Doctrine, you have technological changes. Cable television, which is an advent really of the 1980s, that's when it starts to spread from MTV to CNN, creates this 24-hour news cycle, and it also creates narrowcasting, where stations specialize on focusing on small parts of the audience. So that converges with the end of the Fairness Doctrine, and you have the kind of stations and talk that you have today.
You picked 74 because of Vietnam and Watergate, correct?
Yeah, we had to start with something, but we believe that Nixon's resignation, A, is a traumatic moment. I mean, the president steps down and leaves in the middle of one of the worst scandals we ever had, and it brings together many of the tensions over Vietnam. The beginning of the economic crisis of the 1970s is happening those years, and a lot of the social tensions over issues like busing are starting to open up. So that's why we picked 74.
And you also talk about before we leave the go back in the history of this, I want to get back to the media for a second.
Yeah.
Do you think that we'd be better off, and I don't even know if it's possible with the proliferation of stations, but we would be better off if there were a Fairness Doctrine?
It's too late. I think what we try to show
cable
is...
Cable wasn't subject to it anyway.
That's exactly right. This was for the networks and the radio stations that needed to request public space, essentially.
Yeah.
Cable doesn't depend on that. The internet doesn't depend on that. So it's probably too late. Any kind of change now, I think, and we both think, we've written about this, has to come from internally, from within media organizations. I think it would be very hard for the government to put that back.
Can we go from media organizations to parties and how much a role I'll call it, I don't know if it's your word, intolerance of the parties for differing opinions has contributed to the fault lines you describe on all these issues for the last several decades?
That's part of it. You know, the hardening of partisan divisions in the 70s included a new idea, really, that you see take root, in which the other party is vilified, in which there really isn't any room for compromise. We do argue the trend is more pronounced with Republicans in this period than it is with Democrats. The Democrats remain more eclectic and more divided. Republicans become more unified. But that is a central part of our political discourse. It's not just ideas. It's also the way the parties work. So the primary system in presidential campaigns that really takes form in the 70s, that fuels the role of party activists, who are the ones who will participate most, and other forms of changes like that are relevant.
Well, gerrymandering, which is one of Marjorie's favorite topics, contributes to that clearly as well, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Gerrymandering and the organization of Congress. Starting in the 70s, the party leaders have more tools, campaign finance money, for example, to make sure everyone votes the same way. And if you're a dissenter, you're going to lose your campaign money and you might be primaried out of a seat.
And what about the rise of the so-called moral majority?
Yeah, that's the start of our story. The conservative movement is the story of the 1970s, and the moral majority is at the heart of it. These are largely evangelical Christians who are deciding to participate in politics. They're responding to the Roe v. Wade decision. They're also responding to the battle over the ERA in the 1970s. Phyllis Schlafly is one of the figures. And it comes together with people like Jerry Falwell, who by the end of the 70s are saying, we need to be part of the political process. And they align with Ronald Reagan in 1980 and the GOP.
And the evangelical movement now has become even more powerful since then. They don't call themselves the moral majority anymore.
Oh, absolutely. Then they were new. Then they were fresh in some ways. They were an oppositional force. I think you can argue by now they are part of the political establishment. And they're very sophisticated. They have much more organization. And the connection with the Republican Party right now is totally solid. And you see that, for example, with federal judiciary picks, how there's very little wiggle room for Republican to go against some of these groups.
You know, you mentioned, when we were, Marjorie asked you the question, we're talking to Julian Zelizer, who's a co-author of Fault Lines. You, in answer to Marjorie's question about what if we had the Fairness Doctrine again, you said, not your words, the genie's out of the bottle. Is the genie out of the bottle on all these kinds of things? Because I have to say that you know, we talked about the parties a minute ago. I have moved in recent years because of the polarization. I often quote the line from Barack Obama, you don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. I used to always let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I just want something now. And I don't think I'm that atypical. So are we living in a time, forget where our leaders are. We know where our leaders are. Where real people are craving an end to the polarization, or are we just part of this whole fault line process?
I don't think massive amounts of people are craving an end to it yet, only in that we live with it. Most people are not fighting against it or even proposing real reforms. You don't see people on the street saying gerrymander reform is essential right now, redistricting reform. We have to have that on the table. That's the point you have to reach where your kind of concerns are translated into how we fix government. It is fixable. There are changes that can be made in campaign finance and redistricting, even in the presidential selection process. But politicians will never do that on their own. They benefit from the system.
What's a change in the presidential selection process since we're in this phase right now that would help relieve what you described?
Well, I think if your concerns are the concerns we're moving on, I do think something that the superdelegate process was trying to get at, which is some pushback to how the primaries work, some voice for the party, might not be that form, but another form come convention time that can be part of the selection
process.
But
the Democratic Party's gone in the exact opposite direction in response to Bernie Sanders' complaints.
Absolutely right. But I think that was the purpose of the mechanism.
So you said if politicians won't do something about this, then obviously the American citizens have to.
Well, and it could be, look, one form that could take is good government reform types. That's what we saw in the 70s, Common Cause, Ralph Nader, groups that said process matters as much as policy. But it could also come today through groups that are concerned with policy and say that the dysfunction is preventing us from dealing with issues. So the Parkland students are a great example of a group that could end up saying, you know what, if we want to deal with the issue of gun control, we're also going to have to deal with process issues. And you can see this on the right as well. So I think that's where the social movement pressure might eventually converge with your concerns of how the process works.
We're talking with Julian Zelizer. The book is Fault Lines. To me, this particular period in our life, the Trump presidency, is different because there are so many people that are so upset. You know, that we talked about this before. You know, the great line from our buddy Bill McKibben from The Environmentalist, mm-hmm. who said, you know, previously Bush won, Gore lost. You know, Kerry lost, Bush, whatever. You could go for days or weeks without even thinking about the president of the United States. And now he's got burdened everybody's brain, and that has brought to a level of frenzy people that were not really engaged at all before.
Yes. I mean, look, the frenzy was building before he even declared he was going to run. If Just look back at your own shows and at the papers in the 2010s, and the Tea Party is coming to town in Washington, and the fights over Obama are getting pretty fierce. So polarization is not an invention of the Trump presidency. We finished this book before he was president, and we ended up adding a chapter. So our points were exactly the same. I think he's a manifestation of many of the dysfunctions and tensions in our political system, and he kind of puts them out there without any sort of restraint. So I think that's why he fuels the animosity even more, combined with the media. I mean, he exploits the media unlike any president recently. And so he injects the anger and the division directly into our bloodstream. But he didn't create it.
You know, we talk a lot about civic education here. Massachusetts just passed a bill to join a majority of states that have something. And as you were just speaking to Marjorie a minute ago, how much is stupidity? I don't mean that as crassly as it sounds. Marjorie and I had never seen Sarah Palin until a bunch of years ago, and she spoke at a rally at Boston Common. And the first sign we saw as we entered the park was the one everybody's seen on television a million times, but I don't think I at least believed it was real until I saw it in the flesh. Don't let the federal government take over my Medicare. And I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, this can't, you know, what do you do about this? Is the fact that people, long before Donald Trump, in my estimation, knew so little about so much, in part the genesis of this fault line of yours?
It's clearly part of the mix. You want people to have as much information, real information, as possible if these debates are going to take place. You would hope the debates would then be better. But it's not simply a lack of information. It's the fragmentation of information. So people are not sharing the same set of facts anymore. So you can't really even if every school child has the best civic education right now, my guess is by their late teens and early 20s, they'll be watching different stations, listening to different programs, and they won't even agree on what the fundamentals are. So I think that's the place where this really takes off.
You know, Julian Zelizer, what I was doing lying in bed last night reading your book is I was thinking about the sequel to Fault Lines. I know you're worried about selling what you've got. And I decided that if you wrote a sequel, that chapter one was going to be Supreme Court of the United States. I know you mentioned Supreme Court here, but in all likelihood, based upon, you know, life expectancy tables, it's reasonable to conclude that if Donald Trump completes his first term, he will have a pretty significant conservative majority of 50-year-old members of the Supreme Court of the United States. How do you see the likely trajectory of the Supreme Court playing into future fault lines in this country?
Well, look, the court will essentially institutionalize the conservative movement that took form in the 70s with the moral majority and others. And that's a long-term change. So if President Trump completes this part of his project, and he already has, I mean, the court has now shifted, I think you're going to see very consequential rulings coming out in the next decade or so on all these hot-button issues that we're writing about, but with the hand of the Supreme Court. And that will, you know, keep putting the tensions right on the table. And it will make it harder, even if a presidential candidate promises to heal the nation, to really do that, because we are not in agreement on the questions that are going to come before the court.
But you also wonder, and this is very Pollyanna-ish of me, so it's probably a hopeless thought, but that when you look at what young people think about climate change, about gay rights, about transgender rights, about abortion, about race, all these hot button issues, in many cases, they're a 180 from some of the people that have gotten onto the Supreme Court. So I do see this, and the Supreme Court people, whatever you think of them, are smart people. You know, are they going to just rule at a 180 from what Americans think and want and believe until they keel over at 95?
Congress is doing it.
Right. So if we take the example of gun control, public support has been very clear on some kinds of measures in the, you know, for some time now because of these horrendous shootings that happen. It's a majority opinion. Younger people believe it. Even suburban, powerful suburban voters believe it. And yet our political system, Congress, and even the courts thus far don't really do anything. So that's where I'd be leery to kind of say that's going to happen. Institutions don't necessarily change with public opinion. Climate change is the same. There's broad support for doing big things right now, but the system is totally gridlocked.
Do you want to end on a positive note? Do you have any positive note for us, Julian?
Sure. Look, the one story that we tell that is positive is we look at different social movements in this period, from the conservative movement to the Parkland students, and we look at how they do have the ability to change opinion on key issues. One quick story, the gay rights movement, we look at how they really forced the government to deal with AIDS and AIDS research in the 80s. It starts with Ronald Reagan not even uttering the word and his press secretary mocking people in the press conference when they brought up the issue. And it ends with George W. Bush launching the biggest AIDS initiative overseas that we've ever had. And that's a result of grassroots protests and energy. And that can happen again.
So the only way for anybody to get their opinions taken seriously by increasingly conservative Supreme Court is to be constantly in the streets protesting?
Well, it doesn't have to be in the streets anymore. We have other avenues to do that. But yes, social protest is the only way in which you change how political leaders are thinking. It doesn't happen automatically.
And tweeting is not enough in answer to your question, Margie. Let me just make that clear.
It's not enough. Right.
Julian,
okay.
Congratulations. It's great to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We appreciate
very much.
It.
Thanks for having me.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a political analyst at CNN. You can catch him tonight at the Massachusetts Historical Society at 6 o'clock. His latest book, which he co-authored with Kevin Cruz, is Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Thank you very much, Julian, for coming in. And coming up, from a nation divided to a family divided, we're opening the lines and asking you about your own household info wars. What happens when parents post everything about their kids and their family life online without asking the kids first? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. In 2019, what rights do children have when it comes to the rite of passage that is Googling oneself? Today, becoming self... I love this story, by the way. Today, becoming self-aware means discovering who you are online. And for a lot of kids, that first internet encounter can be a horrible revelation. Your parents have uploaded your life, the good, the bad, the ugly photos you wish no one had ever seen. It's a new dilemma. It's called sharenting, which I love. I mean, sharenting is the term. It's a new dilemma in the age-old practice of parenting pre-internet. We were talking about this before the show. The breaches of privacy could be, you know, your mother telling your friends you blew your algebra exam. It could be, in our cases, it was the naked baby photo of you in the tub that for some reason is framed and sitting on a bookshelf. But today it is so much more pervasive. So we're opening the lines at 877-301-8970. Asking you parents, do you think you need your kids' consent before blogging about them or posting something on Facebook? The answer is yes, by the way. If you're someone whose parents have taken liberties with your childhood by posting it online, how do you retaliate? How do you protect your privacy? When did moms and dads decide to go this far? You know, there is a story. Our number is 877-301-8970 that totally turned my stomach. There is a story. I don't even know who Christy Tate is, and I hope I'm not bad-mouthing someone who I would otherwise like. She writes about, in the Washington Post, about her fourth-grade daughter finds out, goes online. I guess she Googles herself and finds out there's all this stuff about her. Her daughter comes into her and says, "What is this?" She has thumbnail sketches of the kid as a baby, a toddler, a preschooler, each paired with an essay or a blog post that this Tate woman had written on the subject of parenting. And the kid says, "Why are all these photos of me on the internet?" She wanted to know, and she had a right to know. And then the woman has the gall to write after the kid says, "Please stop this. I'm a young woman or now." And the woman says, "I'm a writer. I can't do that.
I know.
I can't stop." You know, the notion that so many parents feel their kids have absolutely no right to privacy, and the fact that these parents are so insensitive to a kid before they could consent when they're single digits to doing something that's going to horribly embarrass them, It's all about the parents. It's not about the kids,
you know,
by the way.
This has been a big – you probably don't spend a lot of time on mommy blogs.
I do not.
But
no,
there
that's
have
correct.
Been huge numbers of mommy blogs.
On this topic?
Well, they eventually get to this topic.
Oh, okay.
Because the kids get older.
Oh, okay.
So the moms are blogging about, you know, I can't stay – I'm up all night because the baby's up all night, or, you know, what kind of baby formula should use, all this kind of stuff. And then the kids get older, and a lot of – mothers have had to stop doing these blogs because the kids are horrified when they share these terrible stories about the little kids, especially when they're in those preteen years. And, you know, a lot of people that are quite famous for doing this, a million years ago,
like
I'm dating myself, but Anna Quinlan got a column in the New York
Times
writing about her family life with her children. And Joyce Maynard wrote a family life, domestic affairs about her life with her children. That's in the 90s. That's a long time ago. But these mommy bloggers, you know, they talk about how sauce they got, or the fights with the husband, or the drugs they took.
That's fine.
Or,
let them talk about themselves. They can say whatever they want.
Did you want to read that your mother was passed out on the floor, you know, when she should have been taking care of you, kind of thing? I mean, no, you don't want to read those kinds of things. Or you certainly don't want to read about how
well, that's
she
insensitive.
That you ruined her life because you were taking up
well,
so much
I agree,
time.
But that is not nearly to me as offensive and invasive as you explain. You know, by the way, I mentioned, not in jest,
yep.
I was made uncomfortable by little naked photos.
Little Jimmy.
Of me in the bathtub yep. with my you-know-what hanging out, so to speak. I mean, they're tough to deal with.
Yeah.
And these online lives of your children are that on steroids. By the way, Jason said, just texted us a note, which is exactly how I feel. Jason said, I told my mom, anyone asks about me, the only response should be, who? I don't know who that is. It's
your
own kid's life.
But you know, what's also happening, which is not as bad as having these naked pictures of you running around, or your mother saying that you ruined her life by being born, that schools will post things. This one little girl was talking about how she's a swimmer, and she Googled herself when she got to be 11 years old, and she find all these swim scores from her school.
Bless you. Bless
Excuse
you.
Me.
It's okay. Keep sneezing. It's okay. Let me take it over. Or you're done sneezing.
No, it's okay. I'm done sneezing.
Thank you.
But that your life in your school, and that this kid they were in third grade singing some little ditty in the school, and that was all posted online. So
well,
a lot of your private life from your
well, that's not your private life, though. I would argue if you're doing a public thing in a school, that's one thing. A private thing in a school, it's not the school's business without getting the approval of the kid or the parent
well,
to be
apparently
doing
they don't
a photo.
Get the approval
well,
of the
they
parent.
Should.
This kid was horrified that there he was making this giant burrito in the third grade.
Would you not?
He had no idea that he was online.
Can I tell you, this is analogous, and then we're going to get to your calls at 877-301-8897. You and I do a show every single season. One of our many Christmas topics is about those horrible Christmas letters. And I get one that is great by a former coworker of mine. The rest, the bragging about the children is not about the children. It's the parents bragging about themselves for having raised the children
Although,
this way. And most of this celebration of your kids' life, which is way over the line without the kids' consent, in my estimation, is not about the kid. It's about what a great job you did raising the kid.
Although I'm a big hypocrite because I told you before, last
that?
Night a friend of mine, daughter came over with her beautiful little 9-month-old.
Yeah.
And at one point he was trying to stand up and walk around. What were you all doing?
Yeah.
Taking pictures of
and
him.
What are you doing with it? You have it on your phone. If it's in your own phone and they're in your house, it's fine.
But that's
putting it online is a whole different phenomenon.
The idea that because it's on your own phone makes it private, it's just not true anymore.
877-301-8897. Again, the term is sharenting, which is, you know, parents sharing everything about their kids without their parents' consent. I'm appalled by this, by the way. I'm not.
Jim's appalled.
I am. I am really appalled by it. And I'm doubly appalled after having read that writer's piece in the Washington Post, how I just can't stop myself. It's because of who I am.
How many people have gotten pictures of sonograms?
What?
That's
where they usually start.
Yeah.
They say that most of these mommy blogs, and by the way, it's not just mothers. We shouldn't say that. The generic name is mommy blog, but a lot of fathers are just as responsible for this totally unacceptable behavior. Show some discretion, by the way, And just don't do it. I mean, that's the solution. Don't do it. If you're proud of your kid, then hug them. That's my motto. Let's go to Amanda. What are you laughing about?
No, that's a very good motto.
Really?
I like
mean, why does the world have to see everything?
Yeah.
Amanda, you're in Wilmington. I mean, by the way, you and I are both pretty careful talking about our kids, by the way. You're careful about yours. I'm careful about mine. I give some details.
I haven't said.
I don't disclose every single little thing they're doing.
I haven't told anybody they're doing 3 to 5 in Walpole.
Well, you've talked about my father going to jail, which he never did. Repeatedly. Let's go to Amanda in Wilmington. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, how you doing? Long time listener.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
I have children. I have 4 children, 21 all the way to 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just noticing that I had to actually delete my Facebook page because I was getting concerned that all my friends were posting these pictures and then their accounts were public and not private. And I got to thinking, like, that's kind of creepy. Like,
yeah.
What if there are people out there, pedophiles or whatever,
that's another
be,
point. That's
grabbing
a...
pictures? And so I deleted my Facebook account. And then also my 21-year-old, he, you know, he at one time posted some pictures that he wasn't so proud of, and he tried to go get them deleted. And it takes a long time to get that stuff off the internet of yourself. So I'm totally, like, do not put pictures of your kids on the internet. It's not safe. That's
well, can I tell you, Amanda, you raised, I'm really glad you called. You raised the important, there are public safety issues. There are negative impact on your future employment kind of thing. I'm just, my motivation here is about invasion of privacy. I mean, your kid, even when they're little, they are their own separate human being who's going to grow up into being a bigger human being. And you really don't, you're their parent. I don't mean you, one is their parent, but you don't have a right to do something that may cause them discomfort later in life as an older kid. So for all these reasons, public safety, privacy, I think you did a great thing, and I'm really glad you called. Amanda, thanks.
Here's Sally from Newbury saying, isn't this exploitation, especially with
yes.
mommy bloggers
yes.
who get notoriety from tales
yes.
about their children, not to mention an awful lot of money, tales about their children.
Well, which is my point, that it's about them. It's for them that they're doing. It's not to celebrate the successes of their little sweet children. 877-301-8897. I'm getting worked into a frenzy, and I shouldn't. But what worked me into a frenzy is this woman saying her kid objected.
I know.
She did it. That's bad enough. Her 14-year-old says, please stop. And her response is, I can't stop. I don't care if you can't stop. Do it.
Let's go to Yale from Worcester.
Sorry.
Hi, Yale.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking the call. I've been listening to you guys forever. And
thank you.
You make my day go by. I drive
oh, so
a lot
nice.
For my job.
Thanks.
I'm a 61-year-old mom of 3 kids in their 20s. And mm-hmm. My son, who's 27, recently, a few months ago, got his dream job. And I was real proud of him. So I posted it on Facebook and just, you know, how proud I was of him. And he was upset. And it sort of, I was taken aback. And, you know, he had already given his notice at his job. So it wasn't sort of something that people weren't supposed to know about yet. And I was just bursting with pride. And I just kind of feel like I now understand that, you know, even in that situation, it was sort of something I shouldn't have done. I wanted to know what you guys think about that.
I think that is really grown up acknowledgement on your part. I have to say, this may be, Marjorie knows this to be true, even though I do a pretty public thing for a living, I wasn't, particularly as a kid, and even now, I'm not comfortable being talked about and that sort of thing. And the person who should know that best. No, I'm serious about
Hold
that.
Hold on. Well, let's I was not get a carried away here. You're not comfortable being talked about?
Well, no.
I think you'd be with Roger Stone. The other thing that's worse than being talked about
no,
is not being talked
well,
about.
I mean, I shouldn't have said, particularly as a kid, it really made me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It really made, and a parent should be sensitive to that. And if you're not sure, then talk to your kid. And I think it's grown up and wonderful of you that you listened and responded. So I think it's great.
Well, yeah, a lot of these people in these stories.
Thanks
these
for your call,
kids,
by the way. We appreciate it.
Say they want their parents to ask permission.
Yeah, but the problem is by the time, like this 14-year-old, the kid, the story with that Tate woman is the fourth grader. I keep saying 14. She wasn't 14. She was a fourth grader. By the time she's come in,
right.
And she said, I want you to get my consent, which her mother says, I'm not going to do. I'll try to negotiate a deal with you, she basically said. It's too late. Well, how old is a fourth grader? Like 10 or 11? So by the time you're,
well,
whatever they are, 10 probably. But by the time you're a fourth grader, you have 10 years of crap that your parents have already posted about you that is unremovable. By the way, do you know that in many Western European nations, there are laws that allow you to remove, this doesn't exist in this country, you don't have to hire a firm like you do here for a lot of money, to remove things about yourself that you don't want to be public. But since that right or law does not exist in this country, then parents have to show more discretion. But the point I'm trying to make is, by the time you're old enough to consent, to use your word a minute ago, it's too late. The chicken's out of the coop or whatever.
Yeah, several people are emailing, including Robert, that they've taken all their family pictures down from Facebook because they just feel creepy about having their children out there on Facebook. I do too.
Ann in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I'm calling when my son, who's now in his 20s, when he went to a formal as a freshman in high school, one of those semi-formals. Of course, I went to someone else's house, and we all took pictures of our kids all dressed up and everything. And as I was leaving, he said to me, you know you can't post that, right?
Mm.
And I was kind of taken aback by this whole thing. And, of course, I wanted to share these pictures. So I put them on my page, and I didn't tag him in them. I just entitled the whole series of pictures, "The Thing My Relative Went to Today." And he spotted it, of course, and was not happy with it. And he said, I don't care whether you tagged me or not. I just don't want you to do that again. So I didn't. I haven't done it since. Anytime if he's in a picture, I always ask permission to tag.
Right,
or
that's
I
right.
don't put the picture up.
But I understand that you're a little frustrated, but ultimately the final decision should be his, shouldn't it, Ann?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I respect my son enough that I would listen to him, unlike that blogger who said to her daughter, I can't stop.
And I love your call. That's great. And by the way, I'm assuming these are a semi-extreme. I'm assuming in most cases, if you say to your kid, like Anne has done with her son, can I post a picture? More often than not, he or she is going to say yes.
Well,
but if they say no, like Anne's son did, then the answer is no.
There's something really weird to me about Facebook. There's always been something really weird to me. I suppose if you say you just got a new baby and you want to share pictures with, you know, the kid's grandparents or maybe the uncles and you have a small circle or something. But there's, I don't know, there's something weird to me about posting children where people can see them. It just seems, I mean, what,
I'm with
what's,
you. I'm
what's
totally
the matter with
you.
Scrapbook? I know I sound like I'm 110, but.
Or when they come over for dinner or when you go to someone, I mean, there are ways to do it that are not going to be a problem. But Anne was a really important caller. Anne originally did something, she didn't tag her kid. Her kid said, that's not enough for me. Her kid said, please don't do it. And you know what Anne's conclusion is? If he's not happy with it, I'm not going to do it. That is the appropriate way. But until they reach that age where they can give or not give consent, you got to be respectful of your kid's privacy.
Valerie's got a good idea.
What is it?
Just stick to taking pictures of your dogs. Don't post pictures.
Karen and
the animals.
Karen and Rosendale, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling us. Hi.
You're welcome. Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
And I usually call in when I'm really, you're talking about something that really gets me. And
great.
And one of those subjects.
I hope it is.
So the thing that you're talking about today kind of reminds me of the nauseating Christmas letters that people send out.
Yeah.
We talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, it's really bragging, kind of under the guise of checking in with people around Christmas time. And then the other piece, and you know, it's kind of like nobody really cares that much about what's going on in your family except your family.
Yeah, true.
Why do we all have to hear that, one? Two, like you guys were saying earlier, I think parents are, you know, we have a healthy dose of narcissism. That's parenting. But at some point, it's your kid's narrative to tell. And what he or she wants to share, it's their story to share.
I love this.
And the fact that people can't make that separation really does say, this is more about me, and letting the world know that my child's achievements are a direct, you know, kickback to me and what a wonderful parent I am. It makes
Amen.
Yeah, that's a
you
great
said
point.
It perfectly, Karen. Thank you. I'm glad your head was ready to pop off.
That's
thanks
right.
for
sharing
calling.
The, creating their own narrative and storyline. That's
but isn't
a
that
great point.
And it is about the parents. It
yeah.
is, you know, or otherwise you would be respecting your kids' privacy.
No,
and
you,
that sort of
I remember
thing.
You created that great storyline, that narrative
that?
On your website, Jim.
What was that?
You remember the pictures you had on the website?
Yeah, I still do. JimBrowdy.com. What's your point?
The thing from E.T.?
Oh, a listener. A listener,
I think that sums us up perfectly.
At our old radio station, remember when the kid in E.T. is riding his bike? Is it E.T. in the basket in the front?
I think it's my face or your face.
I can't remember. No. But in the movie, the kids ride the bike and E.T.'s in the basket.
In the basket in the front.
Okay,
that's
so
right.
what a listener did is replaced people in movies' faces with ours. And so there is Marjorie riding her bike with me in the basket in the front. And if you go to jimbrowdy.com, you can
check it out. I think it kind of captures the whole whatever. You know
what I'm saying? But you know what? I hope you understand this. That's my website. I decided to show those things or not. That's different than exposing your
child. But not everyone would take that with a grain of salt. Of course, I did.
Okay, apparently.
We look ridiculous.
We're done. It's called Sharenting. Check it out.
Sharenting.
And you parents,
it's from the Washington Post.
Listen to some of these really smart parents.
Christy Tate, T-A-T-E, if you want to look it up. Yeah. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We have a podcast. You can always find it by way of iTunes or the App Store. Tomorrow we're going to be back at the Boston Public Library. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is going to join us, but she's going to be there early at 9 o'clock. So if you're a Pressley fan, you can get down there and see her then.
Say it again. The show doesn't start till 11. The taping with Ayanna Pressley is at 9.
That's right.
When the library opens, join us at 9. You can see her.
Emily Rooney, Shirley Young, Callie Crossey will also be with us. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, and our engineer, John the Claw. Parker, what's on TV, Jim?
Well, we're doing a segment to get you anxious. We're going to have two crack lawyers talk about the Mueller report. What is likely, what's unlikely, what power the Attorney General has, what power Congress has. We're going to explore every single angle of what we're likely to have come in our direction next week. And then two women have written two books about women. Tina Cassidy has written Mr. President, How Long Must We Wait? Jen Dedrick has written She, the People. They're both going to be there. They're going to talk about what they've written about. And one of the common themes are the suffragists who paved the way nearly 100 years ago for the advances we're seeing of women in Congress and other places. Two really interesting books, and I think it'll be a pretty interesting discussion.
Terrific. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy. See you at the library tomorrow.
Yep. Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great day.